Torchwood. Everyone Says Hello by Dan Abnett. Read by Bern Gorman. Chapter 1. His mobile rang at 10 to 5 in the morning. It took a few bleats to rouse him.
"Owen Harper," he answered groggily.
"Hello, Owen," Jack replied, sounding distressingly awake.
"Up and at 'em. It's time to greet the day."
"Do you actually know what time it is?"
Owen mumbled.
"Yeah, thanks."
"What's going on, Jack?"
"Just get over here. We got a live one."
Owen tossed the mobile aside in disgust and hauled himself out of bed. To say he wasn't a morning person was like saying Dr. Crippen wasn't a model husband. Greet the day, indeed. Most mornings, Owen felt like greeting the day with an axe. He certainly wasn't expecting the day to greet him back. Owen went outside, trying to remember where he'd left his car. The skies over Cardiff were just deciding what shade of dawn they wanted to be. He could hear the cry of the gulls mobbing over a garbage scow out in the bay, and the whir of a milk float coming up the road.
"Hello?"
the milkman called out to him as the float rattled by. Owen made a weary nod. The float stopped and the milkman got off, bottles clinking in his wire carrier. He trotted over to Owen and stood in front of him, an odd smile on his face.
"Hello?"
he said again. Owen gave another little nod, his eyes hooded, and added a small wave. He tried to step around the beaming milkman.
"Hello, I'm John Davis,"
the milkman said.
"Okay," said Owen.
"I'm 34, I've got 2 kids, Sally and Tom. My wife's name is Annie. She's from Pontypridd."
"Okay. I haven't always been a milkman. I used to have a job on the trains."
"Okay, right.
Hello,"
John Davis, the milkman, said, the smile still broad on his face.
"Who are you, then?"
"I'm late,"
Owen said, and pushed past the milkman. The milkman didn't come after him, but as he hurried away, Owen could hear him calling out, "Hello?
Hello?"
like a man whose call had been disconnected. Owen's car was parked further down the street. He was unlocking the door when he heard footsteps approaching quite fast. A postman was hurrying along the pavement towards him, pushing a rubber-wheeled mail cart as though he was competing in some sort of trolley dash. He brought it to a halt beside Owen's car, panting from his efforts. He waggled a finger as if to say, "Hang on, let me get my breath back." Owen stared at him. The postman swallowed, smiled, and said,
"Hello."
"Jesus Christ," Owen said, and got in his car. As he drove away, he saw the postman in his rear-view mirror, out in the middle of the road, waving a frankly puzzled wave at the departing car. Gwen Cooper was late. Even that early, the traffic had been shocking. She hurried across Mermaid Quay in the early light, sleepy-eyed and hungry. Her mobile rang.
"Hello? Are you joining us?"
Jack asked.
"Oh, right there. Sorry," she said. 2 minutes."
She clattered down the steps onto the boardwalk. Directly ahead of her was a man, a tourist, his camera around his neck on a strap. Early starter, she thought.
"Hello,"
the man said as she came closer.
"All right. Hello,"
she nodded with a fixed grin, not stopping.
"Hello, I am Kurt Stortzmann from Hamburg," he said. "I was born in 1968. My mother's name is..."
"Whatever, I can't stop. Bye,"
she called. The outer door of the hub entry shut behind her.
"Nut job,"
she said to herself. Gwen was the last to arrive. Yanto put a cup of the world's most wonderful coffee into her hand. She pulled up a chair and sat down. Toshiko was at her station, working intently, sipping her own coffee. Owen sulked miserably at his position, half awake. A full bean grin on his matinee idol face, Captain Jack Harkness came down the metal stairs from his office to join them.
"Okay, boys and girls," he said. "Sorry for the early start, we've got a strange one here."
"Is this about everyone saying hello?"
asked Owen, stifling a yawn.
"Is it what?"
asked Jack, momentarily wrong-footed.
"About people saying hello, just out of nowhere. Hello, like that?"
Owen asked. "Yeah, I just got that," said Gwen. some tourist, just outside. Hello, hello, he says, like he knows me.
Right, yeah, Owen agreed, along with way too much personal information.
Jack blinked patiently at them.
No, he said slowly, this is Torchwood, remember, separate from the government, outside the police, beyond the United Nations.
And up its own arse, suggested Owen.
We're here to combat otherworldly hazards, Jack said, ignoring Owen. Check me on this, but people being solicitous and polite to one another is not an otherworldly hazard. Unless I skipped a meeting.
Gwen and Owen looked doubtful.
Did I skip a meeting?
Jack asked.
Now that would be impolite,
Yanto said dryly.
They kept saying hello,
that's all I'm saying, said Owen with a shrug.
Well, that's called being friendly, Jack told him. You should try it sometime. Tosh?
Tosh punched up a display on her main screen.
This isn't about everyone saying hello. This is about that energy field, Jack advised.
Wow, said Gwen.
Blimey, said Owen.
Exactly, said Tosh.
Something came through the rift last night, said Jack. Something powerful.
It touched down in the Cardiff area, said Tosh. But we don't know specifically where yet. It seems to be shielded or disguised.
All we know is, said Jack, it's broadcasting and maintaining an exotic energy field across the entire city.
The computer-projected image on the screen showed a throbbing aura of light, blanketing the graphics of the city map.
What does it want? Asked Gwen.
All Gemma Sands wanted was a paper so she could do Sudoku on the bus. She had to wait in the corner shop because some old fart at the head of the queue was having a chat with the bloke on the till. 8:41. She was going to miss her ruddy bus if they didn't get a move on. She had the right money. She glanced around. There were five other people in the queue with their newspapers, their cartons of milk, their cheese rolls clutched and ready to be paid for. One of them was a bloke she saw most mornings. He waited at the same bus stop she did, but got on another route. Gemma thought, he was a bit of a creep. 30-something, smartish suit. He always smiled in her direction, not in a cheerful, I see you every morning way. More like, I've seen you looking at me, girl. We should have a proper chat sometime. He was looking at her now. She tried not to make eye contact. That was all she needed. The old fart at the front of the queue was still rambling on to the shopkeeper, and the shopkeeper seemed to be quite taken with the conversation, and showed no indication he was conscious of the other customers waiting.
Come on,
Gemma hissed. 8:43.
They're having quite a chat, said the middle-aged mum in front of Gemma, looking back at her. Some of us are in a hurry, said Gemma.
Tell me about it, her mum agreed.
Gemma started tapping her foot. She looked around. The queue was longer now, almost out the shop door. People were coming in and going right back out again in disgust. The bloke was still looking at her. So creepy. Gemma pushed out of the queue and went up to the counter.
Excuse me, sorry, she said.
The old fart, an old boy buying a copy of the Racing Post, was saying,
So the wife and I moved here in 66, but that was before the estate was built. We lived in Coles Road then.
I had an uncle lived just off Coles Road, the shopkeeper replied. His name was Gerald, but we called him Georgie. He lived at number 7 Oakshot Street. He had a daughter called Fiona.
Number 7, the old boy said. Oh, yeah, I should write that down.
Excuse me, Gemma interrupted. Can I just give you this? It's the right money, Daily Mail.
They both looked at her and smiled. She put the change on the counter. You know you've got a whole ruddy queue of people waiting, don't you? She asked. They kept smiling.
Hello,
said the old man.
Hello,
said the shopkeeper.
Hello, I'm Vernon Hines,
the old man said to her.
All right then, she said.
She frowned and backed away.
Hello, I'm William McGarish,
the shopkeeper said.
Hello, who are you?
The old man asked her.
Ruddy nutters.
She shook her head and marched out of the shop. She reached the bus stop. It was obviously going to be a day for queues. A hopper had pulled in and a line of passengers had formed behind a woman who was deep in conversation with the driver. The driver seemed oblivious to the other would-be passengers, even though some were calling out and tapping impatiently on the bus windows. Her own bus was approaching. As she stepped up ready for it, she saw the creepy bloke in the smartish suit heading towards the stop. He was smiling at her. Right at her. Oh, God, no, spare me. At least her bus was here and she'd be able to leave him behind, waiting for his own ride. The doors scooched open and she got on board, paid her fare, and sat towards the back. As the bus pulled off, she opened her paper, took out her pen, and started on the Sudoku. Someone sat down in the seat in front of her. She looked up. The creepy bloke turned round and smiled at her. "Hello," he said. Against a din of rush hour traffic, four Asian boys laughed and joked as they made their way to school. They met at the bus station every morning and walked the last half a mile to school together, sports bags over their shoulders, uniform ties pulled down casually. Ishram was usually the quietest of them, but today he seemed more reserved than usual to Dev. Listening to his MP3 player again, Dev thought. Indeed, Ishram had his head tilted down as he walked, as if in deep contemplation of music in his ears. "Ishram! Ishram!" Dev called. Samir and Kishore were laughing and shouting as they threw a football to one another. "Ishram!" said Dev, kicking the loose ball back to Kishore. "Ishram! Hello!" Ishram looked up at him. Dev was surprised to see there were no headphone plugs in his ears. There was an odd smile on Ishram's face. "Ishram?" Samir hissed out a warning. Ahead of them, on a street corner, six big lads from the upper school were hanging round. Two of them were smoking. They were all white boys and often made trouble for the Asian kids. It always paid to avoid them, even if it meant walking the long way round to the school gates. "Come on," said Samir quietly. "We'll go around Summer Courtway." Dev nodded. "Yeah, come on." They turned away and took a side street. Ishram didn't follow them.
"Ishram!"
Dev turned back and went to look, Samir and Kishore following him. Ishram was heading straight for the gang of boys.
"What's he doing?"
asked Kishore in disbelief.
"Ishram!"
Samir called out. Ishram didn't look back. The gang of boys, however, heard the shout and raised their heads. They saw the boy walking towards them with a smile on his face.
"Ishram!"
Dev yelled. Ishram walked right up to the bemused youths. They closed in around him like a fence. Ishram looked up at the leader of the gang. A smile never left his face.
"Hello," he said. "I am Ishram Kapoor."
It took them less than 10 seconds to beat him onto the pavement. Alan Kennedy, 26 years old, a supply teacher from the agency, walked into 9F's classroom at registration. "Settle down," he said cheerfully. Although, to be fair, the class was a model of good behaviour. 30 kids, at the desks, faces front and alert, smiling brightly. "Right," he said, putting his bag down on the desk. "Hello then, I am Mr. Kennedy." The scrape of chairs, they all stood up in unison. "Hello, Mr. Kennedy," they chorused. Kennedy was impressed. You didn't find that kind of decorum in many schools these days.
Great. "Hello, then."
"Hello, Mr. Kennedy," they repeated.
They remained standing.
"Hello." "Good. Now, sit yourself."
"Hello, Mr. Kennedy."
He blinked.
"All right, class, joke's over. Sit down and..."
"Hello, Mr. Kennedy. Hello, Mr. Kennedy. Hello, Mr. Kennedy."
Vic Royce took his carry-out coffee back to his cab on the rank outside Cardiff Central Station. Sitting in his own cab, his radio on, Dean Milburn watched Vic approach. All of the regular drivers were on reasonable terms, and everyone was genial with Vic. But it paid to be wary of him. Vic Royce was 6'4" and a fag paper tall, and built like the proverbial outhouse. His worn-out Vauxhall saloon sat low on its shocks every time he climbed into it. Vic was an ex-squaddy and an ex-con. He'd done Borstal as a lad, then joined the army, but he found it hard to stay on the straight and narrow in civvy life. He'd served 18 months for receiving, then a 3-stretch for aggravated assault. Now he was 47-odd, his bulk going to seed, and driving a Cardiff minicab was the longest period of honest occupation he'd held down since getting out of HMP Maidstone. Vic could still be dodgy on the side, selling the odd knock-off or shonky gear out of his car boot, giving someone a smack in the chops of a Friday night for no good reason except special brew. Dean quite liked Vic, for all that. Vic had a charm to him, and quite a brain. Some rainy days they'd sit in the same cab waiting for punters and do a crossword. Vic was good at those. He could tell stories too. In another day and age, Dean thought, Vic Royce would have been someone. With his smarts and his strength, he would have been a leader of men. He'd have probably conquered Europe and Central Asia, given half a chance. But in the 21st century, he was just a thug. Too much aggression to fit in. Too much attitude. Vic waved across to Dean, who waved back. Vic set his coffee down on the roof of his Vauxhall and stood at the open driver's door, listening to his radio chirp and chatter. Dean checked his dashboard clock. 9:07. There was a train due in, and that would mean fares. Dean put his own coffee in the cup holder and tried one more clue, tapping his biro against his teeth. 10 across.
Hey, Vic,
he called out of his window.
What's up, mate? 8 letters, downright capital message, something, something, something.
Vic sniffed in thought. He was wearing a grubby Man City top, the faded Joker tattoo on his broad neck poking out of the collar like a sooty stain.
Acrostic, Vic said.
How's that?
A-C-R-O-S-T-I-C, Vic smiled. Acrostic, trust me.
Tell me it.
A middle-aged woman walked up to Vic from the direction of the station. She was plump and slightly hippie-ish in her clothes and hairstyle. She was smiling, a broad, beaming smile.
Hello, she said.
Vic nodded to her.
Where to?
He asked.
Hello,
she repeated.
Yep, hello,
Vic replied, straightening up from his relaxed position, leaning on the Vauxhall's roof.
Hello, I'm Jane Broading. I live in Carlisle and I'm here to visit my mother. Her name's Jane too. She's 77. She once saw Bob Geldof on the tube. Her favourite smell is cofflinctus. She does Ciroc every Friday night.
The woman kept smiling at Vic. Dean started to undo his seatbelt. He knew, he just knew that this was going to kick off. The woman had to be Asperger's or autistic or something. That was the last sort of person Vic was good at dealing with. He'd snap. Dean knew he had to get between them and offer to take the fare.
I have a sister in Guernsey,
Jane Broading was telling Vic.
And I see her every summer, except last summer when she went to the Pyrenees, as a tourist.
Dean knew he wasn't moving fast enough. His belt had jammed. He yanked at it. He could see a frown spreading across Vic's face, a frown that tightened his brow, clenched the shaved dome of his scalp, and puckered the scar that punctuated his left eyebrow. A scar no one had ever had the balls to ask Vic about. If Vic touched the woman, that would be his license gone. The belt finally reeled in. Dean lunged out of his cap in time to see the strangest thing. Vic looked at the woman, who was still talking, and said,
"Thank you."
Then he got in his Vauxhall and reversed out of the rank, leaving the woman standing on the pavement. The carry-out coffee that had been sitting on the roof of Vic's car tumbled, forgotten down the windscreen and off the bonnet. It burst as it hit the ground, and the milky foam trickled away down a drain. As Vic swung round and pulled into the traffic, Dean caught a glimpse of his face. Vic Royce was smiling. Dean Milburn watched the minicab drive away. He turned to look at the woman on the pavement. She cocked her head and smiled at him. She said,
"Hello, I'm Jane Broading."
Vic Royce pulled into the outside lane. The traffic was slow. Something was going on up ahead. A bus had pulled in, hazards blinking, its disgorged passengers standing around on the pavement and in the road. A police car was parked nearby and two officers were trying to soothe the distraught young woman who had bloodstains down the front of her blouse. Vic stuck on his indicator and nosed out into the line of cars flowing around the obstruction. As he rolled forwards, he retuned his radio. It whined and grizzled, popped and squawked. He found what he was looking for.
"Hello,"
the radio said. "Hello," Vic smiled. The ambulance had arrived. The paramedics boarded the bus and began to work on the man crumpled in one of the rear seats. Gawping faces watched them through the windows.
He wouldn't leave me alone," Gemma Sands told the police officers.
They had wrapped a foil blanket around her and were trying to calm her down. Her voice was fragile, close to snapping.
"Try to stay calm, miss," one of the officers said.
He followed me," Gemma said. "Right onto the bus. He just followed me. I tried to get off, but the bus wouldn't stop."
"Then what happened?" asked the WPC.
I stabbed him in the neck with my pen," Gemma said,
and started to cry again. "What did he say to you exactly?" the WPC asked.
"He kept saying, hello."
Chapter 2. "Okay, we now have one fatality reported," Tosh said, working a station. "Is it connected or is it just people being people?" Jack asked.
"Checking the police report," Tosh replied. "A girl stabbed a bloke in the throat on a bus."
"How's the analysis coming?" Jack asked.
Yanto shook his head. "We knew it was exotic energy. Scan shows it's exotic energy. Sorry, nothing the Hub's databanks have seen before."
"Ooh, hating that," Jack shivered.
"It's firing on the PK scale, though," Yanto added.
"Yeah?
Right up high, according to the registered," said Yanto.
"Gwen? Owen?"
Jack called.
"Oh,
do we have to?" Gwen asked.
"Yes," said Jack.
"Every bloody time," Owen protested.
"Just do it to please me, okay?"
Jack asked.
Gwen and Owen left their stations and sat down either side of a small folding table in the base of the Hub chamber. Owen opened a pack of cards, shuffled them, and then drew one, holding it up so Gwen couldn't see.
"Square," she said.
Owen drew another.
"Triangle,"
said Gwen, just guessing and amused by the whole process. Owen drew another.
"Square again,"
she said.
"Another." "Circle."
"Another."
"Wavy lines."
"Five for five,"
Owen called out. Jack nodded and bent down beside Tosh. "Okay, that's a bust. Let's see if we can break that energy pattern down into..."
"Jack."
"Hang on, Owen."
"Jack."
Jack turned. Owen was standing behind him, his face more than usually dour.
"What?"
Jack snapped.
"When I said five for five," said Owen, "I meant five for five. Positive."
He found out a hand of cards. Square, triangle, square, circle, wavy lines.
"Oh my," said Jack.
"Shit, shit, oh shit,"
Gwen exclaimed from below.
"I'm telepathic, me. I'm a telepath."
"Try not to get overexcited," Jack warned.
He looked at Owen.
"Do me."
Owen shrugged.
"If it's all the same, do me with the cards. Right now."
Owen held up a card.
"Circle,"
said Jack, grinning like a wolf. Owen tossed the card away and drew another.
"Triangle,"
Jack cried. Owen chucked the card over his shoulder and drew another.
"Triangle."
Another.
"Wavy line."
Another.
"Square."
Owen paused and then spilled the rest of the cards into the air with a spurt of his fingers.
"That's just getting scary," he said.
"I was right?" Jack asked. Owen nodded.
"It's telesensual," Jack murmured,
and turned back to Tosh and her screens. "It's linking minds. It's talking to minds."
"Either that or you're remarkably good at cards," Tosh remarked,
glancing at the deck littering the floor plates.
"Not that good," said Jack.
"We're getting some spikes," Yanto called. "Behaviour spikes. Phones, Jack. Telephones are ringing all over the place.
Vic Royce parked his Vauxhall and got out. The worn wooden beads of his seat pad rattled. The pine-scented cardboard air freshener swung from his rearview mirror. It was sunny and warm and quiet. Vic made his way through the still weeds of the vacant lot. He heard a noise. He went back to the car, popped the boot, and took out a length of metal pipe he kept hidden under an oily mat. Hefting it, he wandered back across the empty lot. He heard the noise again and turned, hefting the pipe. A man scrambled towards him through a hole in the chain link. His clothes were torn and his arms and face showed where he'd been stung by nettles. He looked up at Vic. Vic raised the pipe to strike him.
Hello, the man said. He smiled.
Hello, Vic replied, lowering the pipe.
Hello, I'm Alan Kennedy, the man said.
Hello, I'm Victor Royce.
My mother's name is Miriam, said Alan Kennedy. I have a brother called Chris. He likes aircraft. He goes to airports and takes pictures.
I have a brother called Gary, Vic said. He's older than me. He served in the Falklands. My mother's name is Enid.
Vic helped Alan to his feet. They turned and walked together towards the disused garage at the end of the lot. Neither of them was at all alarmed by the glow pulsing from the empty shell of the garage. They went inside. Vic dropped his pipe as the pulsing light stung his eyes. There were two other people there already, a yummy mummy and a milkman, both stock still, staring at the source of the light.
Hello, I'm Johnny Claus, the yummy mummy said, without looking round.
Hello, I'm John Davis, said the milkman.
Hello, I'm Vic Royce, Vic said.
Hello, I'm Alan Kennedy, said Alan.
The light pulsed and said hello to them. Jack watched the slowly loading bars creep their way up Tosh's display. Phone use is up by 87% and rising, Tosh said quietly. Landline and mobile. The local networks are struggling to cope with the burden.
We're showing non-standard activity on commercial call centres too, said Yanto. And on helplines, I mean all helplines. Customer care, after sales, local authority. I've been listening to calls at random. It's just people talk.
His voice trailed off.
People what? Jack asked.
Yanto switched on his console speaker.
Hello, I'm Sarah Fiennes. I have a son called Matthew and my husband's favourite dinner is...
Yanto tapped a button. The speaker voice changed as he switched to another call.
Used to live in Barnsley, but now I live in Pontcanna. I like the smell of nutmeg. I don't like that rap music stuff.
He tapped another button.
Hello, I'm Di Hughes. Hello? Hello?
Hello, I'm Alison Martin. My mother's name is Sandra Bennett.
Yanto hit the mute. Jack raised his eyebrows and whistled.
Okay, he said. I stand corrected. Owen, this is about everyone saying hello.
This field thing, said Gwen. It's some kind of communication device?
A communication effect, said Jack.
He was thinking hard.
Why would it want to get everybody talking to each other?
Owen asked.
Why does anyone talk?
Replied Jack expansively.
To find things out, to exchange information.
Or for company, said Gwen. Jack shrugged.
Well, there's that, but what if...
Go on, said Gwen. Jack began to pace, riffing out loud as ideas came to him.
What if this is a first contact event? Something came through the rift, a visitor, an explorer. It wants to learn about us, but it doesn't want to meet with us face to face.
Why? Asked Owen. Shy? Wary? Tosh suggested.
Bad hair? Party zit?
Added Gwen. I'm going to go with Tosh's answer, said Jack. Wary. Cautious. It wants to size us up and learn about us, so it projects this field across the city and it makes everyone talk. And it learns. It learns about us from what we say to one another.
And then what? Demanded Owen. Once it's learned, then what does it do? Right now, that's the least of our problems, said Jack. He pointed at the main display. The overlaid data graphics painted a very clear picture. 9:37 in the morning, and the city had ground to a halt. Gridlock in the streets. Emergency services offline. Phone systems shutting down. Power stations untended. Hospitals unmanned. All because everyone was too busy talking. We have to do something before this gets completely out of hand, said Jack. Dr. Cornfield said hello to everyone halfway through an appendectomy. He introduced himself to the anaesthetist, the staff nurse, and his assistant, even though they all knew him. He said hello to the patient, too. He started to tell them all about his interest in golf, his sister in Madrid, and a school friend called David he hadn't seen in years. He let the surgical tools slip out of his hands. One clattered on the theatre floor. "For God's sake!" said the staff nurse. Dr. Cornfield just walked out of the theatre.
"Hit the panic!"
the staff nurse ordered. "He's left the patient wide open." She looked desperately at the anaesthetist and the theatre assistant. "Hello, I'm Bob Gordon," said the anaesthetist.
"Hello, I'm Benjamin Okino," said the assistant.
The staff nurse's name was Angie Mercer. She felt no obligation to introduce herself. She ran into the pre-op and snatched the internal phone off the wall. "This is Theatre 7. Urgent, please. I need surgical here absolutely right now." "Hello, I'm Lucy Philpott," said a voice at the other end. Angie Mercer ran out into the corridor. People were milling around aimlessly. Staff, orderlies, patients, all talking to one another. She could see Dr. Cornfield chatting earnestly with an old lady in a wheelchair. "Somebody help me," she called. Everyone turned to look at her.
"Hello,"
they all said. Alarms were starting to sound, but no one was paying any attention. A junior doctor in blood-stained scrubs came slamming out of a nearby theatre.
"Help me! Help me!"
he shouted. Angie ran across to him.
"What the hell's going on, staff?" he asked. "We're in the middle of a bloody procedure and the whole team starts talking. The patient's bleeding out. I can't do it on me own."
"Just stay calm," Angie said.
"I don't know what's going on either. This is mad."
"I'm going to get help," the junior cried, and pushed away through the huddles of people. From the floor-length windows of the corridor, Angie could see down into the car park. People were standing around down there, too. She could see their mouths moving. Cars on the road outside were stationary. An ambulance had come to a halt on the ramp into casualty. Its lights were still flashing. The driver had got out to talk to a service worker with a broom.
"Oh, my God," she whispered, helplessly.
The Blue Estate jumped the lights and caught Brian Hatter's Volvo across the front wing with an ugly crunch. The impact swung both vehicles askew. Brian got out, shaking and confused.
"Bloody idiot," he exclaimed.
The driver of the Blue Estate, a bookish young man with a ginger beard and glasses, also got out. He'd hit his head on something, and blood was streaming down his face.
"Bloody idiot,"
Brian repeated. He paused, realising how much blood there was.
"You're right,"
he added tentatively.
"Hello, I'm Jules MacDonald," the young man said with a smile.
Then he collapsed against Brian's car and slid onto the tarmac.
"Oh, Jesus,"
Brian stammered and stooped to help him. The young man was half conscious. His mouth was moving.
What do you say?"
Brian asked, trying to get the man into the recovery position. The young man's voice was slurred.
"I like the films of Martin Scorsese. I like raspberry jam. My friend Graham lives in Swansea."
"Someone call an ambulance,"
Brian yelled. The bystanders were just looking at him. Some seemed to be talking. Several mobile phones were ringing unanswered. A man came over to join him.
"Phone an ambulance, please,"
Brian said to him.
"Hello, I'm Terry Spicer," the man said.
He smiled down at Brian.
I don't care, phone a bloody ambulance,"
Brian shouted. The man didn't react. He kept smiling.
"I like cod and chips,"
I'm not in favour of council tax.
Shut up! Phone a bloody ambulance now!
I enjoy dog racing and the football,
the man told him.
Brian got to his feet. The man wouldn't get out of his way. He just kept talking. Brian shoved the man, hard enough to knock him over.
Sodding nutcase,
he spat. He ran to his Volvo and fished his own mobile out of the door pocket. It started to ring. He answered it.
What? Hello?
Hello, I'm Julie Hatter.
Julie, get off the line, love. I've had an accident and I need to ring an ambulance.
I take dance classes on a Thursday. My husband's name is Brian.
This is your bloody husband,
Brian exclaimed. We're fond of Italian cuisine. Brian used to fish, but he doesn't anymore.
Julie. Julie, stop it, love. Julie, please stop talking like that. Julie!
PC Tony Pratt was taken aback when his partner, Clive Bevan, got out of the uniform car. This was partly because the uniform car was still moving, and partly because Clive Bevan was driving. To be fair, the uniform car wasn't moving very fast. The morning traffic was as free-flowing as sludge, and they were crawling nose to tail through Roath Park. It had been a funny morning altogether. Something very strange was going on. Odd crowds had started forming without warning or explanation, and there was something up with the radio. Clive had just been pointing out a particularly large crowd that was spilling out into the road up ahead. The people seemed oblivious to the danger of passing traffic and were deep in enthusiastic conversation.
Let's pull in here and find out what this is all about, Tony had suggested.
Clive had nodded, started to say something as he turned the wheel, and then he had just got out of the car.
Oi!
Tony cried. The uniform car had immediately stalled and Tony had been obliged to yank on the handbrake to stop it rolling into the car ahead.
What are you bloody playing at?
He shouted. Clive had left his door wide open and his cap sitting on the dashboard. Tony pulled off his seatbelt and got out.
Clive!
He shouted.
What are you doing, man?
Clive didn't look around. He walked slowly into the crowd and joined their conversation.
Control, said Tony into his radio. This is 6-3. Show us on foot, Broadway.
Odd voices answered him out of the static, snatches of words and phrases.
Bugger, said Tony.
He got the keys out of the ignition, closed and locked both doors, and hurried to catch up with Clive, putting his cap on as he ran. As he reached the crowd, people started to say hello to him. They were all smiling. It was a sunny day and everyone was smiling, but all the same, Tony Pratt felt an uneasy chill that he couldn't account for.
Hello, I'm John O. Bates,
a man said to Tony. Tony ignored him.
All right, someone, what's this about?
Tony asked. No one answered him directly. They were too busy saying hello to him. He shouldered his way through the smiling crowd to reach his partner.
Clive! Oi, Clive!
Tony said, not amused by any of it anymore.
What the sod are you playing at, man? Clive!
Clive Bevan turned to look at him.
Hello, I'm Clive Bevan, he said with a smile. I like watching Countdown. My dad's name is Frank.
Clive? What are you on about?
Clive Bevan had some other things to tell Tony. A whole list of things, a dozen or more facts, some quite personal, all delivered with the same flat smile to accompany them. Tony Pratt was 22. He didn't have much professional experience at all. He certainly didn't have any professional experience that would help him with what was going on around him. He walked back to the uniform car, trying to control his breathing, which was threatening to join his pulse in galloping away towards a panic attack. He tried his radio twice more. All he got was static and voices he didn't want to talk to. He opened the car door, got in behind the wheel, and locked himself inside. The smiling, talking crowd began to gather around his car. They'd crowded Ivor Brown into a corner by the escalators. Muzak was still drifting through the concourse and the fountains were spraying, but both sounds were drowned out by the mounting chatter of voices. He'd given them a verbal warning, of course, but neither that nor the sight of Ivor's dark blue security guard uniform seemed to have any effect.
"That's enough! That's enough!" he ordered. "Back off!"
There was trouble from time to time in the shopping precinct, but Ivor was usually man enough to cope. Purse snatchers, gangs of kids messing around, one time a fight between two women in a shoe shop. But this was like nothing he'd ever known. The people closing in around him were regular shoppers, men and women, a few kids. They were just walking forwards, slowly, steadily, smiling like idiots, and talking at him, talking, talking. Ivor started to panic. The whole situation reminded him of a zombie movie he'd seen. The shambling, blank-eyed figures.
"Get away from me," he roared.
They wouldn't. They just kept coming. He threw a punch and broke a man's nose. He swung his fist again, then shoved at them. A woman fell over. Ivor wasn't proud of that, but he was desperate. He tried to push his way free of the pack. They didn't claw and tear at him like zombies, but they reached out their hands and held onto his clothes gently, tugging, as if trying to persuade him to stay. Sound of their voices were driving him mad. Ivor lashed out again, connecting with something, then rammed his way forward with a strangled cry. Three people went sprawling, toppled by the surge. Ivor scrambled over them, pulling free from the hands that plucked at him. A smiling, talking man blocked his way. Ivor punched him in the neck. Choking, but still, somehow, smiling, the man wobbled backwards, collided with the railing, and fell sideways down the escalator.
"Oh, dear God!" Ivor gasped. I didn't mean to.
He looked down. The man had fallen three quarters of the way down, his head twisted against the hard metal steps. The escalator was slowly bringing his limp body back up to Ivor. There were hands at Ivor's back, hands and voices. Ivor turned. They were right in his face, herding him towards the top of the escalator.
"Go away! Go away!"
Ivor yelled at them. The body of the man who had fallen reached the summit of the escalator and slid out off the rising steps onto the top plate. It took Ivor's feet right out from under him, and he pitched backwards, clutching frantically at the hands that he'd been trying to shake off. It was his turn to fall. His desperate grip dragged two others down with him. Jack made it sound alarmingly simple. Find the source of the field and shut it down. "We'll get out there and into position," he said, handing compact scanning units to Gwen and Owen. "Tosh, you and Yanto mind the shop. Pinpoint that origin for us and we'll move in as soon as you've got it locked."
"Will do," Tosh said.
"I'll get the SUV," said Owen.
Gwen shook her head.
"Gridlock. We'd be better off on foot."
"Great," Owen groaned. "There is way too much running in this job."
Jack opened a strongbox he'd brought up from the vault and distributed chrome cuffs. He locked one around his wrist. It looked like an expensive bracelet watch, minus the watch.
"Signal jammers," he said. "Put them on. Let's hope they give us immunity, or we'll be joining the chattering classes."
They rode the elevator up onto the quay at the base of the water tower and stood for a moment, hidden from human eyes by the elevator's perception filter. Water streamed down the tower's silver form behind them. The sun was bright. There were people everywhere. At first glance, they looked like normal crowds, the usual gaggles of tourists and visitors. But Jack, Gwen and Owen were instantly aware that there was something odd about their dynamic. They were moving too slowly, grouping strangely, their body language flat and unexpressive. Everyone was smiling. Everyone was talking.
"Sort of spooky, isn't it?" Owen said.
Gwen nodded. Jack adjusted his comms earpiece. "Hello?" he said.
"Jack?"
Tosh sounded alarmed. Jack grinned.
"Just a communications check, Tosh."
"Don't do that."
"What?" he asked. "Say hello. It's just a word, Tosh."
"Even so, under the circumstances, don't."
"Okay," said Jack to Gwen and Owen.
"I think we're all wound sufficiently tight. Let's go." They stepped off the elevator platform and out of the perception filter. Now they could be seen. People nearby turned towards them,
Come on, said Jack. They began to move through the crowds. Hellos started to go off around them. Hello,
hello, hello.
People moved towards them, smiling. In seconds, they were surrounded.
Hello.
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 Hands reached out towards them, gently, speculatively. Oh, not liking this much at all, said Gwen.
Hello, I'm Harvey Devlin,
a smiling man said to Jack.
Jack grinned back at him.
I'm sure you are, he replied. He looked at Gwen and Owen.
Start running, he said.
There were six of them in the derelict garage now. John Davis, Alan Kennedy, Janny Clowes, Vic Royce, and two newcomers, Greg Randall and Linda Sosa. Linda was a pretty black girl in a Tesco smock. Greg, tall and grizzled, was dressed in a policeman's uniform. But he wasn't a policeman any longer. No more than Alan was a teacher, or John a milkman, or Vic a cabbie, or Jan a yummy mummy. They were all the same thing. They were heralds. The light had explained this to them. It had explained why it had selected them, and what it needed them to do. They, and others who would be joining them before long, were special. Their minds were particularly receptive. Once the learning phase was finished and all the information gathered and processed, the heralds would be the chosen ones and begin to feed information in the other direction. They would be spokesmen. They would explain things to the rest of their kind and establish full contact. They would convey the message and pave the way. But that would all come later. For now, there was some kind of problem. The light didn't explain to them what that problem was, but Vic, like all the others, could feel that something was wrong. The light was softly pulsing as it fed them the things they would need to know later. It was teaching them philosophies and concepts, revealing itself and its agenda. Behind that soft pulse, though, there was a darkness, like a lump of pain or a knot of anxiety. Vic enjoyed the feeling that he was special, but he was troubled by the fact that the light wasn't happy. He wanted it to be happy.
Tell us what's wrong, he said. We'll fix it.
We want to fix it, said Linda. The light wanted them to wait. They waited obediently. The teaching continued, information flowing rhythmically with a gentle pulse. Then the light winced. It dimmed and flickered briefly before its radiance returned. They all felt it. Jan gasped. Alan shivered. Vic took a step forwards. He had a long philtrum, a hair lip that had been repaired in childhood, and it covered his upper teeth. When he grimaced, his lower teeth were revealed like the underbite of a piranha. Let us help you, he said. The light winced again. They all felt the tremble of pain. Something was intruding, and that just wouldn't do. Chapter 3
It's like a bloody war zone, Owen puffed.
The three of them stopped running and slowed to a halt, breathing hard. Owen bent over and rested his hands on his knees. They were crossing the city centre, the busy heartland of stores, offices and restaurants. It was a mess. Car and premises alarms were ringing out a jangled chorus of confusion. Shop fronts had been smashed and fragments of glass littered the pavements. Abandoned vehicles clogged the roads, some with the engines still running and the doors open. A couple of cars had rammed into one another. Another was parked across a traffic island. At the mouth of a pedestrianised street, a small van was on fire. Personal effects littered the ground everywhere. Newspapers, handbags, coats, bags of shopping, children's toys. They could hear 24 different ringtones from where they were standing. There were people around, too. People standing, oblivious to the chaos, talking to one another. A few began to amble towards them, wearing vacant smiles. Keep moving, Jack advised. Have they turned violent? Asked Gwen. Is this what happens next?
Jack shook his head. I think we've got looters and rioting. Not everyone's been affected, and those that haven't are either scared or taking advantage. Owen pointed at the sky. Beyond the roofline of the nearest shops, several roiling columns of smoke were spilling up into the blue. Some were further away than others.
What do you think? He asked.
Unattended hobs. Irons left on. I don't know. Jack glanced at them. Places are burning because people aren't paying attention. Several figures were getting too close for comfort. They picked up the pace again. As he ran, Owen checked his PDA.
Anything?
Asked Jack.
Not really. These things don't have much range. I think we're going to have to rely on Tosh.
There was a commotion to the left of them. A man ran out of a department store, brandishing a broken chunk of shop fitting. As the smiling figures closed around him, he laid into them with the fitting, snarling and cursing. Two people fell with bleeding head wounds. The man broke through the others and ran out into the street.
Steady! Slow down!
Jack called.
Stay back!
The man shouted.
It's okay,
said Jack calmly, showing his open hands. It's going to be okay. You've got to calm down. Hurting people isn't going to help.
Screw you,
the man spat.
Screw all of you.
Calm it down, said Jack. Please. I'm Jack Harkness.
Don't say that,
Gwen squeaked.
Stop telling me your names,
the man screamed.
Stop telling me your names.
He ran at them, swinging the fitting.
Damn,
said Jack and dodged. The chunk of MDF glanced off his left arm. Owen grabbed the man from the side and struggled with him.
Give it a rest, Owen ordered. Now!
He grappled the piece of shop fitting out of the man's hand, but took a smack in the mouth for his trouble. Owen staggered backwards, holding his face. The man ran for it and disappeared down the street.
You okay?
Jack asked Owen. Owen was dabbing blood from his split lip.
Dandy, he said.
My bad, said Jack. I shouldn't have said that to him. Owen made his best whatever face.
You realise our sidearms are all locked in the SUV strongbox?
Jack shook his head. We're not going to need guns, he said.
But, Owen began.
We are not, Jack said emphatically. These people are people, real people. They're scared, that's all. We're here to help them, not shoot them. Owen didn't look particularly convinced.
Let's just be cautious, Jack told him.
They jogged on and reached the next street in time to see two youths scurrying away from a shattered shopfront carrying a huge plasma screen TV between them like a stretcher. Each street they came to was in a similar state of ruin. The noise became oppressive, the wail of car immobilizers, the jangle of burglar alarms, the tinny melodies of ringtones. They picked their way over people's strewn, discarded belongings. Newspapers blew like tumbleweed in the summer breeze. They passed a gasboard van parked beside a bright orange manhole tent. There was no sign of the driver. He'd vanished halfway through setting up his red and white hazard notices.
Tosh,
Jack called into his earpiece mic. You still with us?
Yes, Jack. I've got your signal on the GPS.
I need something, Tosh.
I know, we're working on it. It's really hard to narrow down the field source. There's so much electronic activity in the city zone.
Tell me you're close, Tosh, said Jack. It's a real mess out here and it isn't going to get much better.
We think we're onto something, Jack. Stand by.
They stopped and waited, watching their surroundings. A teenage boy scuttled by, hugging the shop fronts, too scared to stop. Outside a department store, Sally Gatterson was telling John Purvis about her son, who was at college in Sheffield. As they waited, they could hear the conversation distinctly.
He's doing PPE. He's very clever. His father is in local government. I like soup,
the man replied.
I like minestrone. I like books by Dick Francis. I collect stamps. I once went to Malta. I like watching the Playboy Channel when my wife's out.
I like that Dermot Gavin. I've never had a proper orgasm.
Ouch, murmured Jack.
Too much information all around.
Tosh?
Working,
the comms answered.
You smell something? Owen asked.
I like cats, they heard Sally Gatterson saying. I'm allergic to nuts.
That explains the whole orgasm thing, Jack muttered.
Stop it, said Gwen. That is not funny.
I know. They are so
open and vulnerable, Gwen said.
I got lost once on the A40,
John Purvis told Sally Gatterson.
I refused to admit I was lost. My wife and I had a terrible argument. I don't think I'm a very good driver. I once hit a boy on a zebra crossing. I didn't stop.
Oh, God, said Gwen. It's all coming out, said Jack. The field stripped them bare. Every secret, every last hidden detail. God, I wonder how many ugly truths are coming out today. How many secrets, do you think? I don't want to think, said Gwen.
Seriously, do you smell something? Owen asked. A man in late middle age joined Sally Gutterson and John Purvis in front of the department store. He'd lost one sleeve of his jacket somewhere. His presence made the automatic doors open and close. The smiling trio didn't notice.
Hello, I'm Ronald Lucas, he said.
Hello, I'm Sally Gatterson.
Hello, I'm John Purvis.
I drink too much, said Ronald Lucas. I strike my wife on occasion. I like to holiday in the Algarve. I once made a model of the Cacti Sark out of Bulsa. I visit prostitutes twice a month and pay for unprotected sex.
Jesus Christ, murmured Gwen. The whole truth and nothing but the truth, Jack replied. Whatever this thing is, it's getting right at the dark heart of us all. Makes me wonder.
What?
Asked Owen. Whatever it is, said Jack, I wonder what the hell it's going to think of us when it's heard everything we've got to confess. They looked at one another.
Tosh,
Jack urged. Nearly there, Jack. Hang on. Do you hear that? Gwen asked, looking around.
Not here. Smell, said Owen. Do you smell something, I said?
No, Gwen replied. Do either of you hear that?
Ringtones, said Owen.
Sirens, said Jack. Lots of ringtones, said Owen.
That is not a ruddy ringtone, said Gwen.
Look, I'll be straight back, I promise. She crossed the road.
Keep an eye on her,
Jack nodded to Owen. Owen started forwards. Tosh, Jack cooed, turning in a slow circle. Clocks are ticking.
Please be patient, said Tosh.
Gwen edged forward. A cell phone dropped on the pavement nearby was playing Colonel Bogey. Behind that, she heard. She started to run.
Gwen!
Owen called, chasing after her. There were suddenly a lot of greeters around, closing in from all sides.
Gwen!
He turned.
Jack!
Jack heard him and took a few steps. A teenage girl ran out of nowhere in front of him and stopped dead, staring at him. Her cheeks were trapped with mascara.
Don't hurt me, she said.
It's okay, Jack replied.
He had to force himself not to smile a reassuring smile.
I'm not going to say my name, and I'm not going to say hello either, okay?
The girl nodded and flung herself against him, sobbing into his greatcoat.
There, there, Jack whispered. It's all going to be okay.
Gwyn skidded to a halt 50 yards away. The abandoned pushchair had come to rest against a wheelie bin by the curb.
Dear God, she said.
The baby was about 18 months old, squalling wildly, its face red and puffy.
Oh, come on now. It's all right, she crooned, reaching in to stroke its face. It's all right, lovely. Come on.
Gwen, Owen called out, coming up behind her.
It's a baby, Owen. It's a little baby. It's just left here. I knew I could hear something.
Gwen, Owen murmured. He turned slowly. The breeze was in his face now. He sniffed.
You smell that? Something's burning.
Yes, Cardiff, she called back to him.
No,
he said.
Something close. Smouldering rubber or something.
Owen looked back up the street and saw Jack hugging the weeping girl. He saw the gas board van and the bright orange manhole tent behind Jack.
Jack! Move!
He yelled, running back towards Jack. Jack looked up, still holding the girl.
What?
He asked. Jack, said Tosh in his ear. I think we've got it. I think... The fireball ripped up into the air out of the manhole. Leaking gas fumes collected under the tent lit off as a frayed section of power trunking finally burned through. The blast lifted the tent 20 feet off the ground and incinerated the plastic flesh of its wire frame.
It threw the gasboard van over on its side and shot the half-set red and white hazard notices in all directions.
The blast shock knocked Owen over backwards. All the storefront windows became glass blizzards as they blew in.
Sally Gatterson, John Purvis, Ronald Lucas, and 30 other greeters were thrown into the shop fronts like broken puppets. The blistering, expanding rush of flame engulfed Jack and the girl entirely.
Jack? Said Tosh. Jack? Respond. What the hell was that?
Mine's gone dead, said Yanto ominously. Tosh looked at him uneasily. There was a strange silence, broken only by the blip of their screens and the constant patter of the water in the base of the hub.
Reconnect, she instructed.
I can't. He'll ring us back. We have to stay on this now. Jack would want us to stay focused on this.
Tosh nodded. Yanto was right.
They'd methodically tightened the search down to a 2-kilometre patch of the northern suburbs. The field source was there, somewhere. They almost had it pinpointed.
Okay, bring up 3.6, said Tosh, tapping codes on her keyboard.
3.6,
Yanto repeated. We are so close. Magnify map view.
On your screen now.
She peered at the resolving image. Tightening parameters, she said. Boost the resolution to 5 billion.
5 billion,
Yanto acknowledged. Okay, I think I've got it now. Magnify 887. Her voice trailed off.
Tosh?
Yanto called. Goodness sake. What is that? She whispered.
The amber aura of the field was suddenly blooming black, and the stain was spreading.
Not a clue, said Yanto.
It's reacting to us, Tosh said quietly. It feels us. It knows we're here.
How? Yanto asked.
I don't know, but it does. It sensed our scans and it's responding. It's resisting.
Bloody hell, Yanto murmured.
Tosh, it's invasive.
One by one, their monitors were milking out. Shut down, Tosh cried. Shut down now before it cooks our entire system.
They punched keys frantically. 5 of the display screens shut down with soft blinks and projected the words, stand by. The rest burned out and died in dirty ripples of light and data junk. The hub went dark, except for the residual backlighting. They could both smell smoke and melted plastics.
I think it just killed about 2 million quid's worth of hardware, said Yanto.
We were lucky to save what we did, Tosh replied. I've never seen anything quite so aggressive. It just came at us as soon as we were close. It just came right for us and chewed us up.
Yanto's face was a violet ghost in the half-light. What do we do? He asked.
Tosh groped on her workstation for a comms unit. She found it and fitted it into her ear. Jack? Jack? Speak to me. Jack?
In the garage, Vic Royce and the other heralds relaxed slightly. The intrusion had been denied. The light was pulsing cleanly again.
What happens now?
Vic asked.
It'll tell us when it's ready,
John Davis told him.
I want to know now,
Vic replied.
Calm down, said Greg Randall. No one put you in charge, mate.
Yes, it did, Greg. It just put me in charge, Vic said.
He turned to face Greg Randall, his expression impassive. Greg stared back at him for a moment, then looked at the light. He nodded.
I stand corrected. It did put you in charge. Pardon me, Vic. Sorry about that.
No worries, Vic said.
What do we do, Vic? Jan asked.
It's still not safe. We're still not safe, Vic murmured. Enemies are coming. We have to get ready. Find some weapons.
The broken gas main was torching a constant 3-metre flame into the air out of the manhole, like a giant Bunsen burner. The street around was scorched black. Broken glass dripped out of the shattered store windows.
The window displays were full of bloody, shredded corpses twisted amongst the shattered mannequins. Owen got up, his hair singed. He blinked at the devastation around him.
Jack!
He coughed.
You're heavy, mister, the girl said.
Sorry, said Jack. He rolled off her and got up.
I thought you were dead, said the girl.
Rumours of my demise are often exaggerated, Jack Harkness told her. He held out a hand and hoisted her to her feet.
You should have been killed. That explosion, the girl said.
I got lucky, said Jack.
I should have been killed too.
Well, guess I kind of shielded you from the force of the blast, said Jack.
Well, what shielded you? The girl asked.
I'm going to shoot for God's own grace. Will that do? The girl nodded.
I'd
like to know your name, Jack said.
Laurie Coleman,
the girl said. Jack nodded and stuck out his hand. I'm Jack. Nice to know you, Laurie, he said. She shook his hand.
It's nice to know you too, she said.
Owen ran up to them. All the street bins along the pavement on both sides of them were either smashed over or ablaze. Lazy billows of smoke fogged the air.
Jack?
Like a bad penny, Jack grinned. Look after Laurie, won't you? Laurie, this is my friend Owen.
Watch out, Owen said.
Jack turned away.
Tosh?
He called.
Tosh, hello?
He put his hand up to his earpiece and felt the molten fragments of it fall apart.
Oh. That close, was it?
Jack mused. Owen, my link's dead. Get Tosh up, would you?
Sure, said Owen.
Tosh? Tosh, it's Owen. Come back.
I've got her, he said to Jack a moment later. She sounds pretty worked up.
Well, tell her we're okay and tell her to stand by, Jack said.
Problem, Gwen announced, wheeling the pushchair up to them. The baby inside was still bawling.
I have to stay here, Jack. We can't leave the poor thing.
Got a baby sister, Laurie? Jack asked. Laurie shook her head.
Baby brother, she said.
Think you could look after this little guy till his mother comes back? He asked.
Oh, of course I can, said Laurie.
Get yourself and the pram into cover. Maybe the changing rooms of that store over there. Keep low until everything comes together. Laurie took hold of the pushchair handles.
Will it come together, Jack?
She asked. I swear it will, said Jack. Now scoot and hide. When things come back online, that little sweetheart's mum is going to want to find her. They stood and watched as Laurie trundled the pushchair away into the store. Owen? Jack asked. Owen fumbled with his comms.
Tosh. Tosh. What have you got?
Repeat. Highly aggressive, Tosh was saying. The moment we got too close for its liking, it damn well fried us.
Anything salvageable? Owen asked.
Yanto's checking it now. It was vicious.
What are you planning to do about it?
We're going to isolate one section of the hub's network and restart it, Tosh told him. Then we'll take a cautious peek. If it senses us and reacts again, we'll only lose that section.
Well, what'd you get before the system crashed? Owen asked.
We narrowed it down to a half-kilometre square patch in the northern suburbs, Pentwyn, the Shepherd's Hill area.
Jack and Owen had entered a corner newsagent's at the end of the street.
Jack was helping himself to ordnance survey maps from a spinner display.
Shepherd's Hill,
Owen relayed, listening to Tosh in his ear. Jack opened a map and spread it out on the lid of a display freezer.
Got it, he said. Tosh says, definitely east of St. Stephen's and north of the railway line.
Jack nodded, tracing his finger along the map.
Okay, that's narrowed it. Once we're in the area, we can use our PDAs to chase it down.
Tosh advised extreme caution.
Naturally. She'll try to gather some more data via the hub, but she's going to have to be careful, said Owen.
Tell her I understand, Jack said. Gwen came into the shop and tossed a mobile phone to Jack.
It was just lying in the street, she said.
Jack dialed quickly.
Hi, Tosh. It's Jack. I'm on this number now. Log it.
They headed north. The sky had turned a funny colour, as if the light had soured. A great many columns of smoke were rising from the city. They passed a bakery, burning out of control. A fire was spreading to neighbouring shops. There were greeters everywhere, huddled in close, gossiping groups, sharing increasingly intimate secrets. Some greeters moved towards them as they approached, so they kept jogging, keeping to the centre of the roads, moving between the lines of abandoned traffic. From a road bridge, they saw an intercity train stopped on the tracks. Most of its passengers stood on the trackside gravel around it, talking. Others were walking away purposefully, along the line, talking to themselves. A silver 4x4 drove by, very fast, music blaring from its open windows. It was driving down the pavement to get around the gridlock. The people inside waved to them. "Some people will always find a way to turn a situation like this into an excuse for fun," said Jack.
"A situation like this being?" asked Owen.
Jack shrugged. "I don't know. The apocalypse?" "Look," said Gwen. Up ahead, an electronic roadside billboard overlooked the road. The billboard was flashing the word "Hello" again and again and again. Chapter 4. In the end, PC Tony Pratt had simply turned the radio off. He felt reasonably secure inside the locked uniform car, but he couldn't stand the way the voices were leaking in through the radio, so he disconnected the battery. He'd been driving around for quite a while, moving randomly through the streets, or at least through the streets where there was room to drive. There were stranded vehicles everywhere he went. Half a dozen times he saw police cars left with their doors open. One had its light bar still flashing. There was no sign of any officers. He drove aimlessly around the city, sometimes mounting the curb or driving across roundabouts or reservations to avoid obstructions. Apart from the lines of empty vehicles, there were the crowds, the slowly moving, blankly smiling huddles that either ignored him completely, so deep were they in dialogue, or moved towards him as if drawn by the sound of his engine. He saw several things that shocked him. It was clear that more than one house fire was burning unchecked in the central area. He passed a nice family house that was blazing inside and pushing thick black smoke out of its fanlight windows. Not long after that, he drove past a second-hand car lot. The mobile site office, a prefab on locked wheels, had combusted so completely it was just a scorched and smoking shell. Flames had spread out along the lot's plastic bunting, and waxy gobbets of molten pennant were dripping onto the pre-owned cars below. A large Dennis fire engine was parked on the forecourt. Its doors and side shutters were open, and the hard pan around it was littered with discarded pieces of equipment and yellow fire helmets. The blaze must have started early, and the engine called out, but then, like Clive Bevan, the fireman had evidently found something more compelling to do. He saw a dustbin lorry that had rolled, brakeless, through the timber fence of a builder's yard. He saw a Passat that had rammed a set of traffic lights head-on. There was blood and broken glass on the tarmac around it. He saw an ambulance parked outside a small terraced house. Its back doors were open, and there was a gurney waiting to be loaded into it. There was someone on the gurney. Tony pulled up. He took a deep breath, swallowed hard, and unlocked his door. He ran over to the gurney. Under the thin red blanket and the oxygen mask, there was a very old, very frail woman who was quite dead. The young PC felt his pulse elevate again. He backed away and returned to his car. He drove another mile or two, then pulled over, turned off the engine. He took Clive Bevan's cap off the dashboard, tossed it into the back seat, and fought the urge to cry. A silver 4x4 made him jump as it sped by. He heard a snatch of loud music as it hammered past. "Oh my God," he whispered. He started the engine and took off after it. Vic Royce stood on the roof of an outbuilding and stared south. The length of metal pipe hung limply in his right hand. The sky was swollen with cloud, as if a heavy summer storm was coming in across the bay. Dozens of smoke plumes, rising from all across the city, were adding to the sky's smudged darkness. Some were just threads of smoke, the issue of small fires, but others were huge. It looked like an entire factory was ablaze in Tremorpha.
Vic?
John Davis called. Vic got down off the roof via a rain barrel. John was waiting with Linda Sosa in the yard. John was holding a piece of broken railing. Linda had a large, rusty spanner.
Did you see anything, Vic?
John asked.
Are they coming? I didn't see them, but I know they are,
Vic replied.
The light feels it, so it's right. I saw smoke, lots of fires. That speaks of violence. I think this is a dangerous place, just as the light suspected.
This is a proven hostile contact, and the light must be protected, said Linda.
Exactly right, Linda, said Vic.
Greg Randall approached them.
Should we spread out? Search?
He asked.
Yes, said Vic. Let's find them before they find us.
They went back to the garage. A new herald had just arrived.
Hello, I'm Tommy Kincannon, he said.
Hello, Tommy, said Vic.
Tommy Kincannon was tall and heavy, a long-distance lorry driver wearing jeans and bowling shirt. Vic approved. He would be useful. Vic explained what he wanted them to do.
Alan and Janny stay here and watch the light,
Vic said. They both nodded.
Let's go,
he told the rest of them.
Nope, I think it's truly dead, said Jack. He made one last attempt to adjust his PDA and then tossed it into a rubbish bin.
I dropped it when that gas main went up, he said. I thought at the time it had taken a hard knock.
Bit like you, said Gwen.
How are yours looking? Jack asked.
Owen and Gwen were both panning their PDAs around.
Yes, reading the field all right, said Owen.
It's a strong trace, Gwen agreed.
Can you get a fix on the source?
Jack asked.
Let's move around a bit, Owen suggested.
They'd been in Pen Twin for about 10 minutes. The same story had presented itself. More streets full of haphazardly abandoned vehicles and unanswered alarms. Greeters lingered in small groups along the suburban avenues and moved towards the trio when they came into view. Jack, Gwen and Owen moved away from each chorus of hellos.
Damn,
said Jack. What's the matter? Asked Gwen.
Jack was studying his wrist. I don't think my scanner was the only thing that took a knock in that blast.
He showed Gwen. His chrome cuff was cracked and broken.
Oh, Christ, Jack, said Gwen. You're not protected anymore.
End of Disc 1. Disc 2. The 4x4 wasn't slowing down. Tony followed it as closely as he could, occasionally flashing his headlights. He thought about putting on the light bar and siren, but somehow that felt silly. He could see kids inside it, 3, maybe 4 teenagers. Cheeky buggers were waving at him. He'd been on them about 3 minutes when they took a hard right and found there was nowhere to go. The road was blocked by a parcel force van that had been abandoned in the middle of a 3-point turn. The pavements were too narrow for the 4x4 to go round. It braked hard, squealed out blue smoke from its tyres, and knocked over a pair of wheelie bins as it came to rest. The 4x4 tried to reverse, but Tony pulled the uniform car in behind it, blocking it. He leapt out.
Hey, come on. Come on, guys. Forget I'm a cop. I just want to...
The occupants of the 4x4 got out, bringing loud, pumped bass music with them. 3 tall, skinny chav lads and a girl in a Paris Hilton pink satinette tracksuit with matching muffin top.
Piss off!
One of the lads yelled at Tony.
Hey, calm down,
cried Tony.
You're all right, are you? We're frigging great, we are,
another one of the lads yelled over the music.
Till you showed up. Piss off and leave us alone!
Please, stop it with the attitude,
said Tony. I'm not looking to book you or nothing. I just...
What?
Answered the tallest of the boys.
I'm all right. Okay? Said Tony. And you're all right too. You're not doing this whole greeting thing.
The kids told Tony exactly what they thought of the whole greeting thing.
Yeah, right, said Tony, nodding and smiling. The old town's gone nuts. I know. I just wondered if you knew what was going on.
The kids looked at one another. The girl giggled. The music thumped out of the 4x4 behind them.
Who cares?
Said the tallest boy.
I mean, who cares, right?
The others agreed emphatically. Yeah, said Tony, but what's going on?
It's obvious, innit?
Said one of the other boys.
Obvious? It's like Armageddon,
said the girl.
Global warming,
said the other boy.
End of the world, said the tallest boy. It's gotta be. Everyone's turning into friggin' nutters.
Yeah, I suppose, said Tony.
It's gotta be. So we is gonna have a laugh, said the tallest boy. We're gonna party until...
Until what? Asked Tony. They all shrugged. Tony laughed.
Yeah, I would too if I was you,
he murmured. He turned and walked back to the uniform car.
Is that it, Peg?
The tallest boy yelled after him.
Tony looked back at them. Yeah, that's it. Have a good time, he said. No one's stopping you.
He backed the uniform car up to let them out. The 4x4 lurched backwards off the split wheelie bins, then roared away down the road. They waved as they went. Tony Pratt shook his head.
Bye-bye,
he said, and felt more alone than he had all morning.
Jack,
Gwen said sharply, hurrying to keep up with the striding figure in the greatcoat.
We've got things to do, Gwen,
Jack called over his shoulder.
Time is short. We want to talk for a sec,
said Owen.
All ears, Owen.
Look, for God's sake, stop walking for a minute, Gwen said. Jack paused and turned to look at them. He raised his eyebrows at Gwen.
Shoot. Your cuff's broken, Jack, Gwen said. And that is not good, said Owen. You're not covered anymore. You're not protected from the field.
Well, let's hope that doesn't become an issue, Jack said.
Come on. We have to get this done. You have my permission to hit me over the head if I start saying hello to either of you.
Gwen smiled back, but the smile was forced. She had the nasty, nagging feeling that a really bad situation had just taken a turn for the worst.
I can hear a car, said Owen suddenly.
Vic Royce drove his Vauxhall minicab slowly along the road, zagging in and out of the stranded vehicles. In the seat beside him, Linda Sosa was watching the street ahead intently. They saw a trio of people ahead. Vic pulled up.
Wait,
he told Linda. He got out and walked towards the trio, the pipe in his hand. The trio turned to look at him.
Hello,
he said.
Hello, I'm Colin Scott.
Hello, I'm Sherry Teal.
Hello, I'm Maddo Guzman.
My brother is gay, Colin Scott began. He has a boyfriend called...
Okay, said Vic. Okay, you carry on.
He turned and walked back to the minicab. Owen had been quite correct. There was definitely a car approaching. They could hear its engine note echoing around the buildings. A police car, a Mondeo, turned the corner and came down the street at a walking pace. It bumped up on the curb to avoid a line of deserted vehicles. Jack watched it coming towards them. He turned to Gwen and Owen quickly, his face suddenly solemn.
Talk to me, right now, he hissed.
What? Said Gwen.
Huddle up and talk to me like we've been affected. Both of you, quickly.
They turned to face each other, forming a little inwardly turned group.
What's going on?
Owen whispered.
It's a police car, said Gwen.
Yeah, I know, said Jack quietly. Don't look at it. Just talk to me.
But just talk.
Play act.
I'm Gwen Cooper. My boyfriend is called Rhys. I like lasagna, said Gwen, rolling her eyes.
I'm Owen Harper. I quite like lasagna too, I suppose.
I'm Jack Harkness. I make the best damn lasagna in the free world.
Keep talking, keep talking. Smile at me, for God's sake, Owen.
The police car crawled by on the far side of the road.
If I could look, Gwen said, maybe I'd recognise him. I still know a lot of people from when I was in uniform.
She was finding it hard to maintain the fixed grin.
Just look at me, said Jack firmly.
I like playing with frisbees. I like Labrador dogs, who also like playing with frisbees.
Come on, you two.
I've been known to enjoy frisbee-related antics in my time, said Gwen.
I hate frisbees, said Owen. People who play frisbee are saddos.
The police car began to accelerate as it moved away from them. It drove off down the street and disappeared round the next corner.
Jack relaxed. He fumed out of breath.
Okay, what was that all about?
Asked Gwen.
It was about being careful, Jack replied.
That was someone in a car, someone driving a car. They can't have been affected. We haven't seen any greeters driving so far. They could have helped us.
Greeters? Asked Jack. Is that what we're calling them now?
I don't know, Gwen shrugged.
Look, call it a hunch, said Jack. I think the guys in that car were bad news.
Why?
Asked Owen.
Did you see them?
Jack asked.
You wouldn't let us, said Gwen.
I saw them, said Jack, plain as day. And I'll tell you what I saw. A cop riding shotgun in a car driven by a milkman.
A milkman?
Plain as day, said Jack. What kind of cop lets a milkman drive his car for him?
A cop caught up in this? Gwen suggested.
A cop and a milkman, both unaffected, sticking together for support, driving round together, said Owen. I don't know,
Jack shook his head.
There was something dodgy about them. They were trouble.
Oh, come on, Jack.
Just a hunch, Jack replied.
He couldn't bring himself to tell them the real reason. Lionel Melly saw the police car approaching and ran out into the street. He waved his arms.
Sir, please, help me. The world's gone mad.
Stop here, Greg Randall told John Davis. John Davis obediently brought the police car to a halt. Greg Randall got out. Lionel Melly trotted towards him.
Oh, thank God, thank God. I was beginning to think I was alone. Everyone's gone crazy, please. Sir, help me, will you?
Greg Randall looked at him.
Have you seen the light? He asked. Have I what?
Lionel Melly faltered.
Have you spoken? Asked Greg Randall. Look, everything's gone mad this morning, Lionel Melly replied. My wife, she starts talking at me, telling me things I already know. I can't get her to be quiet. I come outside and everyone in the street's the same. And then I saw you, you're police. You must know what's going on.
I do, said Greg Randall. I know that you have resisted the light.
In what?
Greg Randall snapped open his ASP and swung the telescopic metal baton hard into the side of Lionel Melly's skull. The first blow killed him. He fell sideways into the thick box hedge that divided his front garden from the street and lay tangled in its springy mass. Greg Randall clubbed him twice more to be sure. When he walked back to the police car, there was blood and hair matting the ASP.
Drive on,
he told John Davis. Jack Harkness breathed deeply. He could feel the faint fingernail scratches on the surface of his mind. His cuff, his jammer, was defunct, and the telesensual presence of the field was slowly and inexorably oozing into his mind. That was how he'd recognised the threat of the police car, the milkman and the grizzled senior cop. He hadn't even needed to see them to understand the danger that they'd represented. He'd felt it, felt their tingling menace. How could he tell Owen and Gwen that without losing their trust? How could he tell them that he was beginning to be submerged by the alien will? How much longer did he have before he was drowned in the flood? Okay, the signal's tightening up, Owen was saying, as he checked his scanner's reading. Northwest, maybe half a kilometre.
I hear another car, said Gwen.
Blanket, said Jack. Drill like before. Talk to me. Play act.
Jack didn't have any particular tingling sense of menace, but he didn't want to take any chances. He knew he couldn't trust himself. For the second time in 10 minutes, a police car appeared around the top of the road. This time it was a Lumo-striped Astra, and it was driving rather faster. It went right by them, then stopped hard in a grind of brake disc and reversed to a halt. A young, uniformed copper leapt out. "Gwen?" he called. "Ignore him," Jack hissed. "Gwen Cooper?" the copper called out, coming closer. "Oh, God. Tony Pratt," said Gwen, turning. The young policeman hugged Gwen tightly. "Okay. All right, it's all right, Tony," Gwen said.
"She knows him," Owen remarked to Jack.
"Evidently," Jack replied. They were safe. The young policeman was no threat. Jack had a feeling.
"I thought I bloody recognised you," the young policeman said to Gwen, stepping back.
"This is Tony," said Gwen to Jack and Owen. "I knew him back when I was on the force."
"I thought you were still on the force," said Tony.
"I heard you moved to a special division."
"She did," said Jack.
The young PC really was okay. Jack knew that as surely as he'd known the other police car had been trouble. He relaxed slightly. Tony looked at him.
"Look, do you know what's going on? Any idea?"
"What do you think, Tony?" Jack asked. The young policeman was evidently at his wit's end.
"I don't know. Seriously, everyone's gone nuts, even control. The radio, I've been driving around all morning trying to find somebody sane."
"It's okay," said Gwen.
"I saw you, I just..."
"It's okay," Gwen repeated.
"I know what you all used to say about me. Pratt by name, Pratt by nature."
"We never said that," Gwen insisted.
"But it's not me, is it? It's not me. The world's gone frigging bonkers, pardon my French."
"The world has indeed gone frigging bonkers," said Jack smoothly.
"Tell me about it,"
Tony Pratt laughed.
"Christ above, it's nice to find someone who isn't saying bloody hello. Do you know what's going on?"
"No, but we're hoping to," said Jack.
"Your boss, is he?"
Tony asked Gwen.
Yep, said Gwen.
"So?" Tony asked.
"Help me out here. I don't know what to do."
"We could use a ride," Owen said to Jack quietly. "I'm asked if I'm walking anymore."
"Let's join forces," Jack said to Tony.
PC Tony Pratt smiled. It was the best news he'd had all day.
They got into the Astra. In the back, Owen and Gwen adjusted their scanners.
"What are those?" Tony asked, putting on his seatbelt.
Scanners, said Gwen.
"Like Geiger counters?" Tony asked.
"It's radiation, isn't it? There's been a leak. Radiation has made everybody go mad."
Gwen looked over at Jack.
"Yeah, it's radiation, Tony," Jack said. "You're spot on."
Tony put the Astra in gear.
"Where to?"
he asked. He felt upbeat now. His confidence had returned. He felt like he was doing something purposeful.
"Just drive around, Tony," said Jack.
The silver 4x4 came to rest on the pavement in a slither of wheels. The three lads got out and invaded the off-licence. The girl, Colleen, sat in the back seat, nodding her head in time to the pulsing music. The boys went into the off-licence. There was no one around to stop them, but they made it an assault anyway. Barry, the tallest boy, the leader of the band, hefted up a crate of wine bottles and hurled it out through the front window. The plate glass exploded in a shower. Colleen laughed and clapped her hands. Barry was showing off. The other two, Lol and Pat, were showing off for her benefit too. She didn't know their full or real names. She'd only met them that morning. Lol was chucking beer bottles out into the street, laughing as they smashed and frothed. Pat was shaking cans and spraying them around like a Formula One winner.
"Laddie, hurry up,"
Colleen sniggered, yelling out the window. The 4x4 CD stacker switched to a track she really liked. She leant forward between the front seats to max the volume. Barry came out of the off-licence with a plastic-sealed carton of canned beer. He opened the 4x4's back door and plonked it on the seat beside Colleen.
"Look after these, will you?" he grinned. "There's more where that came from."
Hurry up, Colleen told him.
Why?
Barry grinned at her.
You in a hurry to be somewhere?
He winked, suggesting where that somewhere might be. Colleen looked past him. Her eyes widened. That's why, she whispered. Barry turned. A Vauxhall minicab, old and past its best, had pulled up by the curb 20 yards away. A man was walking towards them. He was big, really big. His head was shaved and he was wearing a Man City top stretched over his bulky torso. There was a funny, blurry tattoo, like the face of a playing card, on his thick neck. The man wasn't smiling, but his mouth was open and his lower teeth were exposed, a piranha grin.
What does he want?
Barry asked.
Bloody hell. Be careful,
Colleen whispered. Barry turned to face Vic Royce. Vic Royce came to a halt 5 feet from the tall lad. He eyed him up and down. He was a foot taller than Barry and 100 pounds heavier.
Yeah?
Asked Barry.
Have you seen the light?
Vic asked.
You are,
Barry replied.
Piss off.
Listen to me, boy. Have you seen the light? Have you spoken?
Vic asked.
Piss off, Barry repeated. If you want booze, there's plenty in there for everyone. Help yourself.
Barry!
Colleen hissed. Vic looked at Barry once more. He opened his right hand. A length of metal pipe that had been concealed behind his arm dropped into his grip. He weighed it in his hand lazily.
Have you seen the light, you little shit?
He asked.
Piss off, you!
Barry replied. Vic Royce took a step forward. A hurled beer bottle shattered across his head and he fell down on one knee, suds and blood coursing down his scalp.
Let's go!
Lowell yelled, running out of the off-licence. Pat followed him, lobbing another bottle at Vic. The bottle splintered against Vic's right cheek.
Barry! Go!
Pat yelled. Vic Royce spat out shards of glass, blood and beer foam. He got to his feet. Colleen started to scream. The boys were moving fast, but not fast enough. Vic Royce charged them like a bull. He was swinging the metal pipe. His first blow found the base of Pat's spine and made a noise like a fist hitting a punch bag. Pat fell flat on his face with a grunt and couldn't get up. Vic finished the job with a second vicious swing. Lowell roared and hurled a bottle at Vic, which Vic ducked. Lowell threw another bottle that bounced intact off Vic's chest. Vic hefted the pipe like a baseball bat and knocked Lowell off his feet. By then, Barry was in the driving seat of the 4x4, gunning the engine. The length of pole stabbed in through the driver's window, shattering it. Barry fell sideways onto the passenger seat. Colleen threw herself out of the 4x4's rear door and began to run, screaming. 30 feet from the 4x4, she ran into a small black girl in a Tesco smock.
Run! Run away, you silly bitch!
Colleen shrieked.
Why?
Asked Linda Sosa, as she swung a large, rusty spanner towards Colleen's skull. Chapter 5
Whoops-a-daisy, said Tony Pratt.
Snuggling the uniform car slowly between two stranded vehicles, he'd scraped a wheel arch against a back wing. They'd all felt the bump.
Don't worry about it, said Owen from the back. I don't think anyone's going to hold a little paintwork dink against you in the big scheme of things.
Guess not, Tony grinned, easing them forward.
Radiation leak, he said.
He'd said it several times already in the last 10 minutes, as if trying the phrase out for size.
So what's leaked?
Asked Tony.
From where?
That's what we're trying to work out, said Jack.
Speaking of which, he added, looking over his shoulder at Owen and Gwen in the back seat. They were both watching their portable scanners.
Keep on north still, said Gwen.
Yeah, north, said Owen.
Maybe try the next left, Gwen suggested.
Righto, said Tony. So you're like, specialists, are you? That's right, said Jack.
The young PC's endless stream of nervous questions was beginning to get on his wick. He was finding it hard to concentrate. The fingernail scratches on the surface of his mind were getting louder, like an animal scratching at a door to be let out. Or in.
Specialist radiation police?
Tony asked, steering around a Skoda.
No, we're
Jack began. He stopped short, closed his eyes for a second in an effort to remain calm.
You're right. That's what we are. South Wales Police Specialist Radiation Division. Undercover squad.
Tony let out a low, heartfelt whistle that suggested he was quite impressed by that. Gwen felt a rather different response. She knew Jack well enough to know when he was tense or uncomfortable. Right now, there was a tetchy catch in his voice and a simmering quality in his body language. They were all tense, but Jack was unusually wound tight by his own standards. Gwen caught Owen's eye. She directed her gaze significantly in Jack's direction and then looked down meaningfully at her chrome cuff. Owen nodded in agreement.
It was stop, start, all the way. Tony Pratt drove with unnecessary timidity. They'd get a clear stretch for a dozen yards, maybe even a whole street, then they'd have to go around something or squeeze between something or drive on the curb or simply go back.
Oh, this is going to be tight, Tony said. I don't think I'll be fitting us through there.
They had just turned the left, Gwen had suggested. It was a residential street about 100 yards long, with both sides of the road pretty much filled with lines of abandoned cars. A channel, roughly a car's width wide, ran up the middle of the street between the vehicles. But at the mouth ahead of them, a half-turn car had nipped the neck of the channel tight.
I think you can, said Jack. We really want to go up there.
I don't want to scratch the bodywork again, said Tony.
Right, said Jack. Fine, that's fine. We'll walk from here.
He reached over to undo his belt.
No, there's no need for that, said Gwen.
I'll see you through. How about that? I'll get you through the gap, no problem. She got out and walked around to stand in front of the car, beckoning with both hands to Tony. Tony nudged forwards, over-revving the engine.
That's nice, Gwen called, still beckoning. Left hand down a bit. That's good. Bags of room.
They crept forwards, the engine racing.
Come on now,
Gwen called, gesturing like an airport taxi steward.
You got lots of space, I swear.
I honestly believe, said Owen quietly, this is by far the most ridiculous experience I've had since joining this outfit. Chat said nothing.
Come on,
Gwen smiled.
Am I touching that car? Called Tony. I am, aren't I? No, she lied. Little bit more.
As inept as a learner on his first lesson, Tony manoeuvred the uniform car through the space until it was in the channel between the rows of vehicles. Gwen got back in.
See?
She said. Tony began to drive down the narrow channel at 5 miles an hour. Jack's borrowed phone rang.
Tosh?
He said, answering it.
How's it going?
Tosh asked.
Surprisingly slowly, he replied.
Why?
Because we don't want to scratch the bodywork.
I don't understand, said Tosh.
Don't worry, Jack said. How is it with you?
We've restarted one section of the hub network and we're commencing a very circumspect scan. It hasn't reacted again, not yet anyway. From what we can see, the field and the field source seem to be getting stronger. 10-15% rise in output strength since our last scan.
Okay.
Jack, we...
He cut her off.
Tosh, I'm going to have to call you back.
What's the matter? Asked Gwen, leaning forwards.
Oh, hello, said Tony.
They were about 2/3 of the way along the street. A police Mondeo had just turned into the far end of the road. It faced them down the narrow channel. Tony came to a halt.
Back up, said Jack quietly.
No, said Tony. They can...
Back up,
Jack repeated. The Mondeo began to roll towards them.
Back up, Tony, Gwen said firmly. Yeah, come on, said Owen. Don't be a prat all your life.
Hey,
said Tony, looking around at Owen in annoyance.
Stop messing about and back up. Jack growled. Come on, fast, now!
Flustered and surprised by Jack's sharp tone of voice, Tony struggled frantically with the gear stick.
Find reverse!
Jack cried.
Oh my God, find reverse!
The Mondeo was still rolling forwards down the gap towards them. The passenger door opened and a tall, grizzled man in a police uniform got out of the moving car. He slammed the door shut, slipped between the abandoned cars to his left, and started to jog down the pavement towards them. The Mondeo picked up speed to match him. Tony Pratt found reverse. Everyone in the uniform car started shouting, three of them at him. The uniform car began to trundle back down the channel. Tony turned and put his left arm across the back of Jack's seat, the by-the-book position for a reversing driver.
Faster!
Jack snarled at him.
You're joking! Tony replied. This is tight. I don't want to scratch the bodywork. Gwen, get your head down. I can't see.
The Mondeo was gaining speed. Jack could see the milkman at the wheel. It was coming straight at them, 50 miles an hour, 20.
Scratch the bodywork, Jack yelled. Scratch the goddamn bodywork.
Tony put his foot down. The uniform car accelerated backwards, glancing lightly off cars on either side of it. Its reverse gear made a high-pitched whine. The Mondeo came plunging after them.
Hold on,
Jack warned. Travelling a good 10 miles an hour faster than the uniform car, the Mondeo rammed into their grill. It shoved the uniform car hard, dropped speed, and then rammed again. The force of the shunt made the reversing uniform car swing out more wildly and seriously clip several of the vehicles it was passing. Now everyone in the uniform car really was shouting. Tony stamped on the throttle and they flew backwards, gaining pace. Every few seconds there was a thump or a bounce or a squeal as they touched something. The Mondeo gunned on, relentless, shunting them again and again, and actually pushed them along at one point. On the pavement, the cop's jog had turned into a sprint. He came powering down the street, parallel to them, almost keeping pace with the accelerating vehicles. As he ran, he snapped out his ASP.
Come on, come on, come on, come on, come on!
Gwen shrieked.
Stop yelling at me!
Tony yelled. They were rapidly approaching the end of the street, and the tight gap Gwen had carefully waved Tony through not 3 minutes earlier.
Bollocks! Said Tony Pratt.
He kept pressing the accelerator pedal into the rubber mat of the footwell. His arm was still around the back of Jack's seat. Tony made his own gap. The jolt shook all four of them in their seatbelts. The back end of the uniform car shoved the empty vehicles that formed the tight gap aside in a shower of broken glass. Displaced, the dented cars rocked and wobbled on their shocks. The uniform car, dragging its rear bumper, its taillights gone, its back wings as gouged and pocked as a moonscape, came backwards out of the street and skidded hard to the left. The Mondeo shot out after it, sweeping around in front of it and halting on its offside in a squeal of brakes. At full sprint, the cop was 5 yards from the end of the street.
Go! Go!
Jack yelled. Tony threw the uniform car into first and cooked his treads in a sheet of oily wheelspin smoke as he took off. He slalomed around the back end of the Mondeo, which was attempting to reverse and cut them off.
Come on, Jack yelled. Maybe second gear? What do you think?
The window of Jack's door exploded in a shower of pebbly safety glass fragments. Jack shielded his face in surprise. The grizzled cop was running alongside them, gripping the doorframe, raising his baton to strike again.
Get off!
Jack bellowed. The cop, still clinging on and more pulled along by the car than running, slashed his ASP in and put a deep gouge in Jack's doorframe. The tip of the whistling ASP missed Jack's face by a hair's breadth.
He said, get off!
Gwen yelled and slammed her door open. The door panel struck the cop like a body check and hurled him off the accelerating car. He hit the road and rolled several times. The Mondeo, now in pursuit, had to swerve to avoid hitting him.
Keep going, Jack ordered. Fast as you can.
Close your door,
Tony ordered. They crunched sidelong against a park van. The impact squashed Gwen's flapping rear door back into its frame.
It's closed now, said Gwen.
Jack looked at Tony, who was sweating freely and blinking wildly, his hands clenching the wheel.
Nice driving, Jack grinned. I've seen Bullet 9 times, you know, said Tony bravely, evidently not enjoying the experience for a moment.
Gwen and Owen were looking out of the back window.
It's coming after us, Gwen called.
The Mondeo began to close in on the speeding uniform car. A long way behind it, the cop picked himself up and started to run after the chasing cars. Tony threw the wheel hard to avoid an abandoned decorator's van and then yelped as they somehow found a gap between a pair of haphazardly forsaken cars. It was tight. Sparks streamed off the uniform car's side as it shot through. They were doing 50. An inch either way would have been messy.
You're actually getting good at this,
Jack reassured Tony. I thought about traffic for a while, said Tony. Traffic, I thought. And then I thought about how they laugh in highway control when they heard some prat was on the road again. Left! Left! Gwen screeched. Tony yanked the wheel left to take them around a stranded Nissan. They had to mount the curb. At 50+, that felt like all the wheels had left the ground.
Question, Owen said, his voice tight. Can we go back to the running? In hindsight, I favour the running.
The Mondeo plunged after them, its more powerful engine closing the gap further. Tony kept looking at it in his rearview mirror.
They are not giving up, he said, his voice shaky. God almighty, this is like a real car chase, isn't it?
Tell you what, said Owen, rocking and jolting in his restraint. I'll just get out now.
I am having a real car chase, Tony said, heaving on the wheel.
He started to giggle.
a real live car chase, an actual car chase, me.
Tony, said Jack.
I mean, with real skiddy sounds and everything.
Tony, Jack repeated.
Look at me, I'm in a friggin' thank you God car chase.
Tony, Jack snapped. Turn left or you'll be in a body bag.
The road ahead was choked with random vehicles. Tony hauled on the steering wheel and the uniform car's back end planed out wide and loose. The left-hand option wasn't much better. A parade of shops, the street jammed with empty cars. Tony took the pavement option. They hit the pedestrian walk, the uniform car juddering over the pavers, parking meters whipping past as they moved down the inside of the stagnated traffic. Oversteering, the Mondeo slung itself around behind them and followed them, ripping down along the pavement. It closed in, pushing them to increase speed. Tony could see it in the rear view. The Mondeo had lost its front grille and its headlights ramming them. It presented a buck-toothed, raw-eyed face like a predator yawning to bite them. It ran them again, from behind this time. Jack, Gwen, Owen and Tony all lurched forwards and cried out. It rammed again.
I can't outrun it. I can't outrun it, Tony protested.
Another violent shunt hit them from behind.
Tony, hard left, Jack whispered.
They had reached the end of the pavement stretch and were racing out onto the main concourse of the shopping precinct. Directly ahead of them was a row of thick concrete bollards.
Tony heaved frantically on the wheel, braking hard. The uniform car went into a left-hand skid that turned into a wild spin, round and round, tyres screaming.
John Davis, the milkman, 34 years old, father of Sally and Tom, husband of Annie from Pontypridd, saw why the uniform car had suddenly spun out in front of him. He started to brake, but it was far too late. Greg Randell's police-issue Mondeo hit a bollard square on at 83 miles per hour. It folded around the concrete post, which bent over and deformed as it was struck by several tons of mass. The front end of the big fast Ford caved in around the concrete obstruction in a V-shape, and the entire car telescoped into itself, reducing its overall length by 2 metres. Glass blew out in a confetti shower. The engine block smacked into the passenger compartment, and the rear end lifted, the back wheels kicking high like the hind legs of a prancing, unbroken horse. As if tripping over, the disintegrating car somersaulted the shattered peg of the bollard and landed upside down.
Jesus, holy Christ, Tony Pratt declared, getting out of the stalled and battered uniform car.
Jack and Owen got out too, looking at the crumpled wreckage in frank dismay. It had started to burn.
Oh, that's nasty, said Owen.
I can't get out, Gwen said.
Her crumpled rear door was squashed into its frame. She kept yanking at the handle repeatedly.
Don't worry about getting out, said Jack, climbing back in. We're not stopping.
Just so you know, this door's totally buggered, Gwen told him.
Tony and Owen got into the car. There was a moment's silence.
Should we...
Tony began. He was shaking.
No,
said Jack.
We should... see if he's okay, surely, said Tony.
He's dead, said Jack.
He's dead, Tony.
We have to get on. Other lives are at stake. Tony nodded. He turned the key. The engine coughed unhappily. He turned the key again and got it to start. There was a sick, rattling note in the Astra's engine tone.
Down there,
Jack instructed. They drove across the concourse and down a delivery slip onto a main road. The uniform car's engine was making an ugly spluttering sound.
"I think we might have damaged something," Tony said.
"Yeah, the state of my underwear for a start," said Owen.
Out of breath, hurt, Greg Randall ran onto the concourse and came to a halt. He saw the fuming, mangled wreckage of the Mondeo ahead of him. The ASP fell out of his hand with a clunk. He walked towards the crash site, his boots crunching over scattered glass debris. As he came level with the upturned hull of the car, he bent down on his haunches. He peered into the cabin and saw what remained of John Davis. Greg Randall stood up. He looked for the light in his mind, and when he saw it, he looked into it. The brilliance of it made him wince.
"Here," he said. "They're here, right here. We almost had them."
Other minds, close by, absorbed and collated that thought. Greg Randall walked back to where he'd dropped his ASP, picked it up, and started to run again. The uniform car died under them about 5 minutes later. The engine stalled, and they were left sitting in the middle of a crossroads junction. To the left and right were solid lines of stationary, derelict cars, oblivious to the patiently changing traffic lights.
It's no good," said Tony, trying the key. "She's dead."
"Now we walk," announced Jack.
"Hey," said Owen, "look."
They all turned. To their left, beyond the double row of cars facing them, an articulated rig had grumbled out of a side street. It was a huge thing, hauling a humped back container trailer. It pulled to a halt, engine throbbing, facing them along the line of abandoned traffic.
"Everyone get out, right now," Jack said to them.
Up high in his rig's cabin, Tommy Kincannon narrowed his eyes and put the rig in gear. The massive lorry began to roll forwards, picking up pace. It shunted the abandoned cars out of the path like an ocean liner cutting a bow wave through a heavy sea. Black fume snorted from its vertical chrome exhausts.
It gained speed.
Cars buckled and lurched as they were strewn aside.
"Run!"
Owen yelled, getting out of the stricken uniform car and dashing for safety. Jack came after him.
"Gwen!"
Jack cried. He stopped and looked back.
"This bloody door won't open!"
Gwen yelled at him.
"So get out the other side!" Jack shouted. "Come on!"
He'd started running again. Gwen slid herself over to the open door that Owen had escaped through.
"Tony?"
she urged. Tony Pratt was still trying the starter motor.
I can get it," he was saying.
"Forget it, you daft sod! Get out and run!"
Gwen yelled.
"Honestly, Gwen! Tony, run!"
she screamed. The gigantic lorry was travelling at 60 miles an hour as it went past the lights, slicing the last few cars out of its path. Some of them were struck so squarely they overturned. Tommy Kincannon's rig came across the junction and hit the uniform car side-on, running it down like a train. It carried the shredded debris around its bumper for another 20 yards and then came to a halt.
"Oh, my God. Gwen,"
Jack whispered.
"Did she get out? Did she get out?"
Owen asked frantically. Jack looked around. On the far side of the junction, he saw Gwen and Tony stumbling to a halt. They looked his way.
"Thank God," said Jack.
He gestured for Owen to follow him and began to move in Gwen's direction. The rig let out a heavy gasp of air brakes and began to reverse. Jack and Owen skidded to a halt. The rig stopped, swung round, and began to drive towards them.
"Okay, not that way after all," Jack said.
He and Owen turned and ran. Picking up speed, the rig bore down after them.
"Are you all right?" Gwen asked. "Tony, are you all right?"
Pale-faced, he nodded.
I don't understand any of this," he whispered. "I mean, I don't get it at all."
Gwen was craning to see where Jack and Owen had gone to. The rig had ploughed off in their direction. She dialed Owen. His phone didn't pick up.
"Do we go after them?" asked Tony.
She shook her head.
"No. We can stay in contact. We keep on.
She'd had the presence of mind to keep hold of her scanner. She checked it. "We were close," she said. "Before that bloody police car came after us, we were really close."
"To the source of the leak?" Tony asked.
Yeah. Right. Let's go back that way." She began to jog down the street. "Come on, Tony." He ran to catch up. "And keep your eyes peeled," she added. They took the first left, weaving in and out of the frozen traffic. A few hellos echoed in their direction. They'd been moving for about 2 minutes when they saw a figure running towards them. It was the cop. On foot, Jack and Owen could go places an 18-wheeler couldn't. Cars and vans couldn't shelter them, but an alley between two shops worked just fine. Tommy Kincannon stopped his rig, jumped down, and came after them in person. Jack's focus had almost entirely gone. The fingernail scratching in his head had become unbearable. "Don't slow down," Owen yelled as they ran, but Jack was lagging. They raced around a street corner and saw a Vauxhall minicab pulling up ahead of them. A large thug in a Man City top and a small black girl got out and came towards them. Jack and Owen peeled left, with all three figures at their heels.
"Not gonna need guns, my ass," Owen groaned.
"Shut up and run," Jack replied.
"Guns are looking pretty clever right now,"
Owen threw back. "Owen, keep running," Jack said through gritted teeth.
"What?
Keep running.
What are you gonna do?"
Owen wanted to know.
"Just keep running," Jack called with some effort. "That's the closest thing to an order I've ever given you."
Owen looked back to see Jack jog wearily to a halt, the three pursuers rushing up behind him. Owen almost stopped, but he saw the look in Jack's eyes. He kept running. Jack turned to face Vic Royce as he closed in. Vic raised his metal pipe to cleave Jack's head.
"Hello, I'm Jack Harkness,"
Jack smiled. Vic faltered, half lowering the pipe.
"Have you seen the light?"
he asked.
"I can see the light," said Jack. "Have you spoken?"
"I am speaking," said Jack. "I'm Jack Harkness. I sometimes use the rank captain. I'm partial to a nice glass of water." Linda and Tommy came up behind Vic.
"He's seen the light," Vic said.
"No, he's pretending," said Linda.
"He is identified as an enemy,"
said Tommy. Vic shook his head.
"He has seen the light. I can feel it."
Linda and Tommy stepped closer, peering into Jack's smiling face.
"You're right, Vic," said Linda. "I think he was resisting, but the light has him now."
"I like to watch the sunrise," said Jack. "I've travelled to the end of the universe. I know about the rift." Vic, Linda and Tommy looked at Jack sharply.
"Gathered information indicates that no one native to this location knows about or understands the rift," said Linda.
"What do we do?"
asked Tommy.
"Linda will take Jack to the light,"
said Vic.
"We will keep hunting for the other enemies."
"There's at least one more," said Tommy. Linda and Jack walked away, side by side. Vic and Tommy headed off in the other direction. When they'd gone by, Owen slowly rose from cover behind a garden hedge. He kept low, checking that the lorry driver and the thug with the pole had gone. Then he made off, quietly and carefully, after Jack. Chapter 6. "We should have heard something by now," said Tosh. Yanto nodded. Tosh leant her elbows on her console and cupped her hands around her mouth, deep in thought. "We've got to do something," she said.
"I'd rather not try probing the field source again," said Yanto.
"Something, though. Maybe we've gone about this all wrong. If it's a communication field, maybe we should be trying to talk to it."
Yanto looked doubtful.
"We don't know what consequences that could have for us or the hub systems."
"I know. Think about it," said Tosh. "The disaster that's going on out there is essentially a byproduct of the field. The city screwed up because everyone has stopped doing what they should be doing, so the field's not necessarily hostile, it's just causing a great big problem."
"I suppose that's one way of looking at it," Yanto admitted.
If Jack and the others can't find it and shut it down, we need a different approach. We need to find another way of stopping it. We need to decide what we want to say to it.
Okay, said Yanto.
I'll try Jack again, said Tosh.
Jack's cell phone started ringing as he was walking with Linda across the deserted lot towards the garage. He ignored it and let it ring out. They went into the garage and Jack saw the light ahead of him. Alan Kennedy and Janny Clowes greeted them. Two more heralds had turned up in the last half an hour. Their names were Christine Dell and Ryan Parrish. They were standing in front of the light and learning the things they would need to know later. Jack stepped forwards and looked into the light. He started to learn immediately. He also became aware of the problem. Behind the soft pulse, he could sense the darkness, like a lump of pain. You're an explorer, Jack said quietly. You've come through the rift. The light pulsed.
No, I'm not like the others. Another pulse. Because like you, I'm not from around here.
The light pulsed again, slowly.
You're cautious, said Jack. When you go to a new place, you project the field to gather data first. But I can't believe you'd want to cause this much pain and suffering. People are dying because of the field.
The light pulsed.
That doesn't make sense, Jack frowned. That's the sort of answer a machine would give. An automatic response.
The light pulsed more brilliantly.
Am I talking to a machine? Jack asked. Am I talking to a system that can't make big decisions?
The light wavered, as if in thought. Jack took a step back and then slowly began to circle the source of the light. The light fluttered.
It's okay, said Jack. I just want to see.
Behind the light sat the object. It wasn't particularly large, and it wasn't in any way terrestrial. It was a black metal sphere, about the size of a small car, sitting on three delicate, intricate legs that had deployed from its base. The metal was odd, with a surface like eggshell. The upper half of the sphere had unfolded, opening like the complex petals of a giant orchid. Another delicate, intricate limb had extended from the interior, projecting past the black petals like a stamen. The tip of the limb was the source of the light, like a deep-sea fish's bioluminescent lure. Jack leaned closer, peering into the sphere's interior. There was a smell that he had absolutely no frame of reference to describe. He let his fingers touch one of the opened black petals. It felt like warm glass.
It's okay, he repeated softly. I just want to see.
He looked into the darkness. He saw.
Oh, God, he murmured.
Greg Randall slowed down to a walking pace and began scanning from side to side. His quarry had disappeared. He'd chased the pair down two streets and then lost sight of them at the street corner. He walked on slowly. To his left was a small row of shops, a bus stop, a church. To his right, the front gates and playground of a junior school. The playground was full of children. He went through the gates. The children, who had been standing in small huddles, talking to one another, began to approach him, calling out hello and telling him their names.
Hello, I'm Greg Randall, he said.
Information flowed out of their smiling mouths, the names of pets, of favourite football teams, of brothers and sisters, of best mates and mortal enemies.
I am looking for my enemies, he said. Give me specific information. A man and a woman running. Did they come this way?
Yes, Greg Randall,
the children said.
Where did they go?
He asked. As one, the children turned and pointed towards the school. Greg Randall approached the swing doors and went inside. He smelled poster paint and rubber flooring. Juvenile art was mounted on display screens down the hallway. Through the sliding window of the school office, Greg could see a middle-aged woman talking on the phone, oblivious to the world around her.
I don't like salads with bits in,
the woman was saying, a faint smile shaping her mouth. I think there's too much sex in the media. I have a cousin called Vernon. He lives in Aberdeen. Greg Randall walked past the office. The woman didn't look up. He went down the corridor, past two classrooms where members of staff were locked in smiling dialogues. He turned left by a giant map of the world. Directly ahead, a pair of glass doors were gently closing on their automatic springs. He opened them and went through. Another corridor with classrooms on both sides. He went past the first door, then stopped and went back. He opened the door and stepped inside. It was an IT suite. Four rows of bench desks, lined with monitors and keyboards, faced a teaching position with an electronic whiteboard. There was a large metal stationery cupboard against the back wall. Every monitor screen displayed the word, "Hello." There was no one in the suite. He began to back out, but then paused. He could smell something. He could smell sweat. He came back in, weighing the ASP in his right hand. He walked around the first row of bench desks and looked underneath. Nothing. He went to the second and looked under it. Nothing. He went to the third. With a strangled cry, Tony Pratt leapt up from under the bench and began to back away. He was drenched in perspiration and shaking madly. Please, he begged. Please. Have you seen the light? Greg Randall asked. I don't know what that means, Tony sobbed. Have you spoken? Please, said Tony. Greg Randall took another step and raised his telescopic baton.
Oh, Christ, said Tony.
There was a sound from behind Greg Randall. He began to turn. The doors of the metal stationery cupboard flew open and Gwen leapt out. She cracked Greg Randall across the back of the head with a spare keyboard. The plastic shattered and dislodged keys flew in all directions like teeth. Greg Randall went over hard, careened off a bench and knocked a monitor onto the floor. He writhed, dazed. Gwen brought the broken keyboard down and knocked him cold.
Surprise! She snarled.
From cover, Owen peeked across the road at the vacant lot and the derelict garage. He'd arrived in time to watch Jack and the girl walk into it. Overhead, the sky had turned a sick, noxious yellow, as if a thunderstorm was about to break. The air felt heavy and hot. He was running with sweat. Owen wiped his mouth with the back of his hand. He activated his comms. Owen? Tosh answered.
Tosh,
he replied in a whisper. Oh, thank God. We thought we'd lost you all.
Very nearly.
Jack's not answering his cell, she said.
If he did, you'd only get hello, Owen said.
What does that mean?
He broke his cuff, Tosh. He's part of it now. It's got into his head.
Are you sure?
Absolutely, I'm afraid, said Owen.
He checked his scanner.
You getting a feed for my PDA?
Stand by. Yes, Yanto's picking you up.
Lock my position, Tosh. I'm on it. I'm on the field source. It's right ahead of me, a disused lockup off Windmill Street, Pentwyn.
Okay, that's great.
What do we do, Tosh?
Owen asked.
I mean, we found it, so what? What do we do now?
There was no answer.
Tosh?
We're trying to work up a plan, Owen. We think maybe we have to communicate with this thing.
Why?
Owen asked. It's a communication field, Owen.
Listen to me, Tosh. It's hostile. There are people out here. It's got hold of people. Possessed them.
Possessed?
Look, I don't know what you want to call it, Tosh, but people have been trying very hard to kill us. Very hard. It's as if it's controlling people to defend itself.
Okay.
Tosh?
I'm thinking, Owen, she replied.
We're making this up as we go along.
Owen? Are you still there? Owen? Owen wasn't listening to her anymore. Alan Kennedy was standing 5 metres to his left, staring at him. Alan Kennedy was holding a length of thick, oily chain. Jenny Clowes was off to his right, clutching a screwdriver. Linda Sosa faced him, the rusty spanner in her tiny hand.
Oh, crap, said Owen.
We're like a team, Tony Pratt grinned.
Almost, Gwen replied. They dragged Greg Randall over to the side of the room and used the cop's own cuffs to chain him to the old, heavy schoolroom radiator.
You did all right, Gwen told Tony, stripping Randall of his equipment and his belt.
Is he dead? Tony asked.
I hope not, but he's not a problem anymore.
Gwen picked up the cop's ASP.
I did all right then?
Tony asked, wiping his forehead.
I just said you did. Next time, though,
said Tony.
I don't want to be the bait.
There won't be a next time, Gwen assured him.
Gwen,
said Tony quietly.
What? I think there might be,
Tony mumbled. She turned. Vic Royce was staring at them through the IT suite's glass door. Owen held up his hands in a half gesture of surrender. He backed up slowly. Linda Sosa, Alan Kennedy and Janny Clowes closed in.
You don't want to do this, Owen said.
They didn't reply. Owen weighed his chances.
There was a high wall behind him. If he was going to make a run for it, he'd have to go past one of the trio. He tried to decide which one was the best option. None of them looked that wise. Whichever way he went, there was a better than even chance he'd get his skull cracked, or worse.
Come on, Owen said.
I'm nothing, just leave me be.
They came closer. Owen swallowed hard.
Hello, I'm Owen Harper, he said, trying to smile. I like puppies and all kinds of shit. My great aunt's name is Hortensia, and I once streaked around the Millennium Centre for a dare.
He's lying, said Linda.
He's pretending, said Alan.
He is resisting the light, said Janny.
Not even credit for trying?
Owen pleaded.
Leave him to me, said another voice.
Jack walked up between Linda and Alan.
I know him. Leave him to me.
Why, Jack? Asked Linda.
I know him. It's better that way, Jack said. He held his hand out and Linda gave him the spanner.
Go back inside, Jack said, staring at Owen.
The light needs you.
Slowly, grudgingly, Alan, Linda and Janny walked back towards the derelict garage. Jack took another step towards Owen and raised the spanner.
Vic Royce burst into the IT suite, his piranha mouth snarling, brandishing the pipe over his head in both hands. Gwen swung the ASP and shattered the nearest window.
Out!
She yelled. Tony yelped and scrambled out through the frame. He dropped down onto the grass outside. Gwen had no opportunity to follow him. She threw herself sideways as Vic made his first swing. His pipe exploded a monitor in a shower of sparks. Gwen vaulted up onto a bench and leapt down the other side, trying to go around her assailant and reach the door. Vic lunged at her, his pipe dragging three more monitors off their mountings. It tangled for a second in the trailing leads. Gwen seized her chance. She brought the ASP down across Vic Royce's extended forearms. He hollered in pain and let go of the pipe. Gwen swung in again and struck him in the chest with the metal baton. Vic crashed over onto the floor. Gwen leapt over him and climbed up out through the broken window. She landed outside on a grassy slope and rolled. The bank of lawn led down to a thicket of trees. She could see Tony running towards the thicket at full stretch. She picked herself up and went after him. Behind her, growling like a wounded bear, Vic Royce came out through the window, cutting his arms on the broken glass edges. He was clutching his pipe again. He began to chase after them.
Tony, run!
Gwen yelled.
Tony Pratt had no intention of doing anything different. He glanced over his shoulder and saw Gwen coming after him down the slope with the shaven-headed thug in the Man City shirt right on her ass.
Come on, Gwen! He shouted.
Something hit him head-on. Tony Pratt fell over, blind and baffled, his head ringing, the salty bite of blood in his mouth. Tommy Kincannon stood over him. He kicked Tony in the ribs and made him grunt and convulse. Tommy bent down, lifted the stunned PC up by his throat, and smashed another raw-knuckled punch across his face. Tommy Kincannon dropped the limp PC. He looked round at the girl coming towards him and saw her falter and slow down. Vic was right behind her. Vic would get her. Tommy knew that. Jack Harkness threw the spanner away over the wall. Owen stopped flinching.
You bastard, Owen gasped. I thought that was me dead, Dennis. I thought you were one of them.
I am one of them, said Jack. Owen looked at Jack warily.
That's a joke, right?
No, said Jack.
Jack?
Jack sighed. The light's in my mind, Owen. I'm directly connected to the telesensual field. I am one of them. I wasn't fooling. The other heralds would have seen through a pretense and killed me. But, Owen began. The field's calibrated for humans, said Jack. But I'm not quite like contemporary humans. I've got a few differences. The field's not affecting me completely. I've become part of it, but I can still think for myself.
Jesus, said Owen.
Jack, we... Shut up, said Jack. I don't know how much longer I've got before the field appreciates the full extent of my immunity and closes its grip.
It's in my head, Owen. It's in my head, and it's saying hello over and over again.
What can I do, Jack? Owen asked. Jack swayed slightly and put a hand to his forehead, as if trying to concentrate his wear of a terrible headache.
We were right about it, he said quietly.
The field is a first contact protocol. The explorer makes landfall and projects the field to learn about his new environment. The field system is fully automated. It extends the field and collates the data it gathers in. It's not hostile.
Oh, yeah, right, Owen started.
Jack Harkness held up his hand. It's not hostile per se, Owen. There's a problem. The explorer didn't survive the landing.
What do you mean? Owen asked. It's dead. I saw it. Inside its craft, it's dead. The field's activated automatically, it's saying hello and it's asking questions, but there's no one there to hear the answers.
Jesus Christ, you sure? Asked Owen. Jack nodded.
Yeah, I'm sure. The field system knows there's something wrong. I don't know if it understands that its owner is dead or not, but without feedback and instruction, the field system is assuming this place is hostile, a proven hostile contact. It's protecting itself and its owner according to its programming.
Owen shook his head.
We're being attacked by a machine because the machine doesn't realize its owner's dead?
Jack smiled. Yeah, that's about right. We're being ripped apart by a perfectly benign communication system because there's no one on the other end to hear us.
Tosh and Yanto, Owen said. They thought our best chance was to talk to it.
Tosh and Yanto are perfectly correct, Jack said. We've just got to be careful and say exactly the right thing. He took out his borrowed phone and dialed. Gwen knew that if she split to the left and made for the tree, she'd probably outrun the growling monster in the Man City shirt. She also knew that if she did that, Tony Pratt would die. She turned, raising the ASP defensively. Vic Roy slowed down and came towards her, the metal pipe swinging in his fist. Tommy Kincannon closed in from the left.
Come on then, you ugly bastards, she taunted, head down, the ASP ready. Come and have a go if you think it hard enough.
They clearly thought they were. They charged at her.
Random? How random do you mean, Jack? Tosh asked.
Completely, entirely random, Jack replied. It's got to be gibberish. Total nonsense. Get the hub to generate a stream of garbage data and send it via this phone.
Where will you be, Jack? Yanto asked. Right inside. I'm the delivery system.
But why total random gibberish? Tosh asked.
Just do it, please, Jack snapped. I'm doing it,
Yanto protested. Vic Royce made a first vicious swing. Gwen ducked and darted backwards. Tommy Kincannon came in at her from the side, and she swept the ASP round, breaking two of his fingers. He yelped and fell back. Vic came in swinging the pipe again, a hefty downward stroke that missed Gwen by just a few inches and tore a divot out of the turf bank.
Shit,
Gwen said. She scrambled backwards up the slope towards the trees, holding the ASP out in a defensive block. They came after her, smiling. Vic came at her again, swatting at her with the pipe. Gwen struck out and snapped the ASP across Vic's right elbow. she heard the bone crack. Vic grunted in pain, and then in fury brought the pipe around one-handed. It hit the back of Gwen's right hand, and the ASP flew out of her broken grip. She screamed. Vic Royce chuckled and closed in for the kill. Jack walked into the garage, towards the light, and opened his phone. The heralds turned to look at him.
"What are you doing?"
Alan asked him.
"Listen," said Jack. "You have to listen. You too."
He directed the last part to the light. He held up the phone. A scrambled noise came out of it, a gibberish signal, totally and exquisitely meaningless, a nonsense concocted by Tosh and Yanto back in the hub. The light listened. It tried to say hello several times, plaintively, experimentally. The light pulsed. It wavered. It cut off. In the hub, Tosh looked at Yanto. "The field," she began. "It just collapsed," he confirmed. She hugged him.
"Steady on,"
Yanto said. Vic Royce dropped the pipe. It hit the turf with a dull thump. He looked at Tommy Kincannon.
"Who are you?" he asked.
"Who are you?"
Tommy replied.
"What the hell are we doing here?"
They looked down at the girl on the grass, clutching her broken hand.
"Who are you?"
Vic asked. "I'm Gwen," she replied.
"And what are we doing here, Gwen?"
Vic asked her. Gwen got up and hurried down the bank towards Tony Pratt. She clutched her aching arm against her chest. "Tony?" He looked up at her, his face swollen and flecked with blood.
"Gwen?"
"I think it's over," she said, gingerly dialing her phone.
"The radiation leak?"
he asked.
"Yes, Tony. The radiation leak."
"How can a radiation leak be over?"
"Oh, hush," she said.
Jack walked out of the garage. Behind him, Alan Kennedy, Janny Clowes, Linda Sosa, and the other heralds wandered out into the sunlight, blinking and confused.
"We're going to need a truck," Jack said to Owen.
"A truck?
We're going to have to shift that craft out into secure storage."
"Are we done?" asked Owen. Jack nodded. It worked.
"How?"
Owen asked.
"We fed it total nonsense," said Jack. "Something it simply couldn't translate or understand. We made it think that it had contacted something too alien for it to comprehend. So it stopped trying. It couldn't do its job. It shut down. It was simply communication software, after all."
Owen shook his head.
"Skin of our teeth," he muttered. "Most days, just by the skin of our teeth."
"Listen," said Jack. "You hear that?"
"Hear what?"
asked Owen. The storm was finally breaking, and drumming thunder was rolling around the sky. It began to rain. The sky was streaked with smoke.
"Hear what?"
Owen repeated.
"That," said Jack.
They listened. Out across the city, one by one, everyone was saying goodbye.
Torchwood, Everyone Says Hello, by Dan Abnett, was read by Bern Gorman. It was produced by Andrew Lawrence and is published by BBC Audiobooks.